Welcome to Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness, Subcommittee on Serious Events, and we've already made our jokes about serious. July 13, 2006. We're waiting at this point for the balance of our committee to get here, and one of the first things that we're going to talk about, and probably one of the more important ones in Oregon, is this idea of port security, and our primary port is the Port of Portland. So if you would please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairman. Glad to be here today. My name is Mark Crosby, and I'm the Chief Public Safety Officer with the Port of Portland. Just our quick thumbnail sketch. You know, we operate four airports in the metro area, of course, PDX being the only commercial service airport, but let's not forget Hillsboro, which is the second busiest airport in the state by a number of takeoffs and landings, and would be absolutely critical should we have some sort of event that damages the bridges and limits transportation. So it's strategically it's good because we have good sized airports on both the east and west sides of the rivers. And we have four marine terminals, three of which we operate and one of which is operated by one of our tenants. So we have a balance of transportation nodes there. And we're also the largest landowner in the Portland metro area. As far as my department, the port has taken some steps under Bill White's direction to consolidate our public safety and security functions. In our department that I manage, we have our police department, our own police department, our own fire department, our own 911 center, our dispatch center, and we have two security departments, one for marine and one for aviation, and then we also have responsibility for overall port-wide emergency management. That last change was made just about 9 months ago, so we're also adjusting to that, but what makes us unique in that respect is there are only a handful, five or six joint port authorities in the country that operate both airports and seaports, and we're the only one that has security and emergency management under one hat. And I think we have that advantage of being a medium-sized port and are able to do that, and we're already seeing some advantages that will come out in the presentation later today. I want to highlight that the port also sent a 16-person team to New Orleans as a part of the hurricane relief efforts, which is the first time we've done something like that, actually mobilize and send people down there. I led that team. We had six firefighters, seven maintenance, one officer, and myself going down to the airport. And that was an invaluable experience that we can take forward. We also, some recent events that we've covered from an emergency management standpoint are the Nike events. Remember when the CEO of Nike was hovering around over our heads? That was a big get-ready event for us and exercised our incident command system, emergency management, and working with our partners in the Hillsboro area. We also had a big ice storm that actually shut down the airport for 4 days a couple years ago, back in January. That was a significant event. And then, of course, 9/11, which shut down. It didn't shut down the airport. The airport never closes. I will say that. Please republish that. The airport never closes. Flights may stop coming and going occasionally, but not very often. We have to keep the airport functioning. And in my spare time, I also am a part of the Oregon Air National Guard as a lieutenant colonel and a commander in our combat communications squadron, which is IT stuff. We also were very busy around last fall working with Ken and the state and our local partners here in the city and the county to organize the operation Welcome Oregon thing at the airport to receive the displaced citizens, which was a great exercise, even though we didn't have to do it. The Port Authority actually worked very closely to organize all that with all of our partners. And then on the guard side, as soon as that slowed down, we mobilized our unit and, as you know, sent 2,000 guardsmen to the New Orleans area, 50 of which came from my squadron. I also had the privilege a couple years ago before commanding the comm squadron to the deputy commander for our civil support team, our weapons of mass destruction civil support team, the Oregon National Guard, that you may have had a demonstration of. It's a 22-person team that is able to jump in as a first responder and help out the civil authorities. It's a wonderful tool that would play out in a lot of the scenarios we would have here in this area. So with that background, I want to kind of lay the land here a little bit on what we think of when we think of security and emergency management. Of course, the ports, both the airports and seaports, are the focal points, are the nerve centers for our global economy and global logistics. That's why Bill's focus over the last 4 years since he took over has been to regain our international direct international service on the airport side and to get our container service back after we lost a couple carriers. And now recently we've gotten two back. Get that to help energize this area. It's the glue that holds together the economy, and that's true in day-to-day operations today, but it's also true obviously during a crisis. The transportation nodes, including the roads and the rail as well, are the things that you want to bring back up and running to get the economy going again, and they're still faced with that down in the Gulf region. I heard a presentation from a gentleman 2 days ago from down in New Orleans, and they still haven't fully recovered that. Terrorism, in particular, has impacts, as we saw from 9/11, like no other, on not only immediate impacts on the economy, to air commerce, but also on trade. There's a ripple effect that no one imagined at the time. What I want to show with those other things I've listed there, the Madrid bombings, USS Cole, the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian bombings and insurgencies in Iraq, is that what they attack are transportation nodes or transportation centers, generally speaking. They go after where the people are, and they try to cripple commerce and put instill fear. So all these events have raised our awareness on security. I mean, security is probably the most used word since 9/11 in our vernacular. It has, in every day we hear something new comes up because there's lots of different facets of security. What I want to show here is just the three most recent examples from recent events. The Dubai deal, brought to light things in marine that weren't in the light but had been there for a long time, just like 9/11 did for aviation. Cybersecurity is an ongoing thing. We've seen a lot of things about the release or the people getting social security numbers, identity theft, et cetera. And then, of course, the most recent thing that the FBI and DHS uncovered, the rail tunnel plots, which would have crippled the commerce in the New York area. The challenge that we face for those of us who have to implement these things is, of course, policy and funding sometimes are in the reactive mode. I mean, we're used to that. That's the nature of our business. We usually are best prepared for a disaster after it happens. That's when the resources come to it. That's just something we have to deal with and have to continuously adjust our crystal ball to. But sometimes it takes us months or years to fix the problem that happened 4 years ago, and by then the resources are being applied elsewhere. So from the basics again, what is security? Because again, it's the most overused word, I think, since 9/11. And you can see there from the dictionary definition that it's freedom from risk. Well, it's something that gives us assured safety. But if you think about that literally, can we ever be really free of risk? And the answer is no. You guys know that. Is it achievable in a free and open society? It's very difficult. So what we like to do is focus on deterrence and not prevention. And the way we do that is by looking at what we can do, prioritizing it, and then adding to what we call the layers of security. The media often focuses us to prevention, and that's an unwinnable game in most cases. So we really try to focus on layers, and that's what I'll talk about here when I describe what we have here for. Because the focus over the last 5 years has been on aviation, I want to start with that, and you'll see some analogies as we go to the marine side, because there are a lot of similarities that we're doing now in marine that we've done in aviation in the past. Remember, aviation security really started about 35 years ago when there was a lot of Cuban hijackings to Cuba. And you know, way back then, there wasn't even metal detectors or anything. So it started with metal detectors. It started with the federal government implying, forcing rules on us to put screening in process. And then we got regulations that we had to create. We're doing that on the Marine side now in the last 4 years. So this presentation will go over what we've done, what we're doing, and then what we see in the future. With anything, what you want to do when you first start is not be reactive and logically think, what's your goal? What are you trying to achieve here so you can achieve it? And there's two major things you have to consider. First of all is what event are you trying to counter? And I just wanted to list a few very broad ones here just to show in this small list of five, there's a lot of stuff there. Conventional things, chemical things, biological / infectious, because getting infectious disease can be intentional or non-intentional. Usually it's unintentional when things spread, but terrorists can theoretically do it intentionally as well. Nuclear, radiological, and of course the big one there. It's only two words, but of course it encompasses a whole other list of natural disaster. So you take those five things, and then you overlay them with, okay, then what are we trying to protect in an airport environment? Typically, we have focused over time on the airplanes themselves, and actually the airplanes in the air, preventing bad things and bad people from getting on airplanes. That has been the primary focus in the last 35 years. The next layer, if you will, is the what we call the secured area, or the area inside the fence, basically. But then you also have to look at facilities and our perimeter. The like I talked about earlier, the terrorism is obviously motivated by places where large groups of people are. They want to make a splash. They want to get on CNN and Fox and all that. And the way you do that is that you go to a place that people recognize, like the World Trade Center or landmarks, and then you go where large groups of people are. Are the people on the aircraft? There's people on the aircraft we want to protect, but there's also employees running around to keep those airplanes safe and service. The other thing that's gotten a fair amount of attention in the last few years is the cargo. And there's a couple types of cargo. What we call belly cargo, which is the cargo underneath all of us when we're flying as a passenger. Amongst that, there's two sets that people don't realize. There's our bags, but there's also the airlines make money on other things that shippers put in there, commerce, business people put in there, pay to put in there to get shipped. And then, of course, the all-cargo aircraft like FedExes and UPSs, DHLs of the world. There's different things to consider for each of those elements. So post 9/11, here's our broad laundry list of the things we've done, most of which I think you're pretty familiar with because it's been in mainstream media. There was a law passed, the Aviation Transportation Security Act, November 19th, 2001. That created the Transportation Security Administration, which took the screening, the screeners, people who screen us from the private sector to the public sector. That was the one main mission of the TSA. The second mission of the TSA relative to aviation is that they took the security inspectors that made sure we were doing our job and took it from the FAA and put it to the TSA. They made us update all of our plans and regulations and everything. We did more extensive background checks on employees. The important thing there is employees. We've done some in the past, but now we did them biometrically or fingerprint-based background checks. And then the two things that got the most bang for our buck for the billions of dollars we've spent in this country on aviation security are, in my opinion, hardening the cockpit doors, which was probably the least expensive, but it did the most value.
My uncle was one of the first airline pilots in the world. I mean, he flew even clipper jets. He used to say years ago, because he flew all over the world, particularly into Asia, and he said, I can't understand why we don't harden the doors. And as soon as Israel came into existence and they began to take action, you know, to deal with the terrorist threat they had, he couldn't understand why we didn't do it. And, you know, and so many times people warn about things because he almost, at one time there was a miscommunication landing in Hong Kong, almost took out downtown Hong Kong with a 707. And he said at the time that you could take out major buildings with a loaded with an aircraft loaded with fuel. And I can remember thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, that's really true because it's a tremendous amount of energy that's stored inside that airplane. And, of course, the access to the control of that is that top big door.
Absolutely.
And it took a long time for someone to listen to that, the pilot.
And the other thing that's not even on here but that had a big effect, which is something that cost no money, which is the changing of all of our perception, which happened even on Flight 93, you know, minutes after the first three attacks, which is we're no longer going to be passive in an airplane. If somebody's aggressively doing something, we're all going to act together and try and intervene. More law enforcement presence. You got the federal air marshals in the airplane. You know, thousands of those folks were in the past. There was only a few dozen. And at the airports, all airport commercial service airports added law enforcement presence. And one area in particular that we added law enforcement presence was in our canine teams, our bog explosive sniffing dogs. We personally went from 2 to 4 teams here in Portland, and we actually have the largest number of explosive detection canine teams in the state, and we are tied in with the metropolitan area bomb detection unit. So we help during other events like the Rose Festival, things like that. The other thing was there was a lot of grants coming our way in the transportation aviation mode, and as you'll see in Marine, same thing. A lot of where we put that money oftentimes is in fencing, cameras, access control, detection tracking, which addresses all the issues that I mentioned in the previous slide. So the other thing about 9/11 is what I call it the great cargo myth, or the great myth about cargo. Most people thought that our bags were screened before 9/11 and by X-ray. They weren't. And so that's why Congress mandated a year after 9/11 that all airports will do electronic screening of checked bags. And that's why we put all those big, expensive, heavy, three-dimensional X-ray machines in our ticket lobby. And that was what we call the interim solution. We had a year to do it. It was amazing that it got done. Meanwhile, the TSA standing up there, 50,000 person strong workforce. We did that. That's our interim solution. Our long-term solution is to get things like they were before, which is the customer drops off their bag at the ticket counter and they're done. Our commission, the Port Commission yesterday, just adopted the next step in that process, which is to approve money for a design plan to move those machines behind the public eye and have a what we call an inline baggage screening system. That's going to take us about a year to design. It'll get done in about 3 years. It's going to be one of our largest capital projects. It's going to cost about anywhere from around $100 to $120 million to do that.
Is there any danger separating the person who brought the bag from the baggie? If you find out you have a problem, you know, is this equipment going to know who dropped it? In other words, camera recording?
Yes.
Okay. Can you quickly identify who had that bag?
It will. The tag itself will have the person's, and it will be tracked electronically as it goes through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so when something alarms, we'll know which bag it is and then know the person. Now, if the person drops it and wanders off, the bag will, we're not going to put the bag on the airplane, obviously. And we would then have to go back and look at our camera coverage and pin down who that person was that dropped it off. But, the good part about that is that if there's ever a problem with the bag, we're going to make sure we're not going to put it on the airplane, and then if the person is milling around, we'll find them. For example, we had to evacuate the terminal back in March because the screening machines are in the ticket lobby, so we had to evacuate the whole north side there. There was a device that the screeners and the police weren't sure what it was. It looked like the makings of a bomb. Turns out we finally tracked down the person. He was a Nike employee. It was a specific device that tracks the distance by which a golf ball goes. And because it was near a battery source and wires, it looked like an explosive device. So we were able to track that person down, and he told us it was innate, you know, so we didn't have to take other measures like blowing up the bag or anything like that. But we did bring in the robot, and we took a while to track it down. The checkpoints, which we all go through, have gone through a couple iterations since 9/11. We widened them. We added new equipment with the TSA. And just last month, we changed them again. We reconfigured them to make them more streamlined to improve the process. Good. And, of course, we all know the prohibited items list and things you can bring on, you know, has changed up and down over the last several years. U.S. Visit is a program done by Customs and Border Protection, part of another agency of Homeland Security, formerly known as Customs and Immigration. What they've done is they've developed a program, a biometric-based program, where when you're going in and out of the country, mostly going coming in the country, you have to register with your fingerprint and your passport. They're looking at expanding that to going out of the country as well, but we have it for outgoing passengers now. Incoming passengers. So I mentioned that as another major. So what's on the horizon for the airport? There's more focus on cargo requirements. There's actually a new rule that just came down from the federal government, adding some requirements on shippers, and freight forwarders. You know, kind of the different pieces of the supply chain. They're reaching out to more branches. They're going further out down the supply chain. And so it's not an imposition on the airport authority, but TSA is getting more involved in that. Again, cargo stuff is only X-rayed on a very limited basis, but that could change in the future. The industry is working with the government to figure out how to best do that without slowing down commerce, frankly. Registered traveler and trusted traveler, those are the programs by which we're trying to figure out a way to have people like you and me be able to get through faster if we're not a threat. You know, we have this balance in this country of weighing, treating everyone the same versus the naughty P word of profiling. And there's different thoughts about how to do that.
Yeah, I just posted about that. I had to fly back to Louisville. No, wait a minute, that was Nashville. Getting ready to leave Nashville, I ended up there about an hour and a half before I needed to be there. So I thought, well, I'm just going to go around and study this whole thing and just see how that works, right? So I went through the security entrance, and I saw the typical thing that you hear people complaining about. In other words, you know, the sweet little old lady who's a little bit overweight, and she's just being strip searched, and you saw other people that I would have pulled in there immediately and checked them. And I watched that for about an hour and a half as that kind of thing went on, and I thought, gosh, I mean, this is profiling in the reverse. The person that I would profile, they let them walk through it. Now, the thing that bothered me, and this is one that gets to my question, when we got ready to board the aircraft, and we were going to fly back to L.A., and so this thing was going to have a pretty good chunk of fuel on board, and it was a pretty big airplane, there was a pilot came up. Obviously, I'm just going to be very politically incorrect and just tell you he was a Middle Eastern ancestor. And I was about from me to you from the check-in stand. He comes in, gets on the computer, you know, to check in as the pilot. He didn't know how to operate it. So I'm sitting here going, whoa, red flags, you know, alarms going off. Finally, the other pilot came in and checked him in. And I'm sitting here thinking, how, because obviously the second pilot, I don't know who the pilot command or the co-pilot, I forget he didn't know this other pilot. And I actually tried to get off of that flight. And I said, you know, this is what happened. Oh, don't worry about it. How do we know that that pilot is supposed to be there and that that pilot is, in fact, you know, appropriately credentialed to fly that aircraft?
As a part of our layers of security, you know, that those responsibilities are on the airline, as you would expect. A lot of times pilots, because they go to all the different airports, they don't have our security badges. You know, they're not based in Portland. Mm-hmm. They're going to come from somewhere else.
Right.
It is relied on the airline's system to identify their pilots. Now, I don't know if you know what his particular situation was, obviously, but I will say that at ticket counters, every airport ticket counter is a little different sometimes. And the computer systems sometimes aren't always the airlines, sometimes they're the airports. So maybe there was something there with that. But in that particular case, it would be reliant upon the airline for him to be able to check in with both the computer and with his people, whatever procedures they have in place.
I would watch that one because I realized, you know, that this was so obvious there was something wrong and nobody did a thing about it. And I have to tell you, that was one of those more faith-based things that I did, was getting on that airplane. Because I positioned myself, okay, how can I take the cockpit? Is that going to be what we have to do here today? But, you know, it's really a real major concern because I'm this close and I'm watching what's going on. I'm actually back behind so I could see him trying to get into the computer. And I'm thinking, oh, my. Anyway, please go ahead.
No. You know, pilots as a whole, and I can say this because I was one at one time. You know, they're pretty A-type people, generally speaking. And they're going to, you know, it's their skin, too. They tend to be fairly, a little bit like law enforcement, you know, a little suspicious and fairly protective, if that gives you any reassurance. But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, the guy in the cockpit hit the ground first. Remember that.
Yeah. So what's going to happen? So anyway, registered traveler, trusted traveler. The balance there is trying to figure out, are we able in this country to develop rules to treat people differently? And right now, TSA is focusing, is saying, no, we're not. We'd rather focus on advances in technology to treat people differently. Meaning, for example, everyone focuses on, us included, why do I have to take off my shoes and take out my laptop? If I'm willing to give you personal, you the government, personal information on myself that shows that I don't have any kind of terrorist ties. And their answer is, well, you know, you just never know. I can argue this both ways, so I understand their perspective. You know, if somebody can plant something on someone who's a known, you know, good person. So they're focusing now on technology, like machines that you stand on that while you're checking in, smell your shoes and see if there's any explosive stuff on them. They exist. They're being tested right now. And like at the airport, we just got four of what we call the puffers. That's the unofficial name. The explosive trace portals, those things you stand in, they blow air at you. Those sniff for explosives. So there isn't an approved program yet by the federal government, but that's what I would see coming is improvements to the checkpoint area. Better technology, but at some point we're going to try and I think we're going to get to a system that in some fashion is acceptable in this country, kind of discerns one person from another, applies risk factors to people. And that's what Trusted Traveler is, which they haven't figured out either how to do without creating a database that is too personal. Another area that they will be focusing on, I think, in the future is scrutiny of employees. We do some now, but they've looked at looking at that area now. Better checkpoint equipment, better perimeter equipment, and just better, again, technology in general for any type of screening system for cargo, for people, stuff like that. So that's the aviation side. Then I'll switch over to the marine side. And again, we start with the same questions. These, again, the things that can happen to varying degrees. With this side, what I'm trying to demonstrate is that marine, it's a little more of a mixed bag as far as who's responsible for security. With the airport, we're responsible for all the physical security. We have the law enforcement, again, our own police force. And we partner primarily with the TSA, who does the physical screening of the passengers and then looks over our shoulder on other stuff. On the marine side, we have three primary folks, and actually four. Coast Guard is that gold symbol there you can't read. The port, of course, and then the other symbol there is for the Customs and Border Protection. The fourth element is the tenants, and I'll talk about that here in a second. So primarily on the water, what we call the water side, you know, everything coming in the water, is the Coast Guard. That's their responsibility. The facility here in Portland is the responsibility of the port, the physical security. However, we're in a minority with respect to Marine Corps, and that's what the Dubai thing kind of fleshed out a little bit. It showed that 90% of all container seaports are operated by private entities. non-government entities. And what that means is it's the they usually hire contract security, the Securitases of the world and all the other companies out there that provide private security to do that. So we're kind of an anomaly in that respect. But we do, it's a team effort. And then you have the ships themselves, of course, coming and going. The people on the ships coming and going, the cargo, and the cargo is while the people is more the focus of the Coast Guard, the cargo, the entity is responsible for tracking the cargo as it comes in via the manifest documents and all that stuff, the paperwork they have to provide before they even get into port. And then once they get here, things are screened not by the TSA, like TSA at the airport, but by Customs and Border Protection at the seaports. The things we have to consider are the containers. And here in Portland, we have all these things at our terminals. In Vancouver, they don't have containers. Vancouver, USA. We have autos. We have break bulk, steel. And we have bulk, which is the wheat, potash, things like that.
Hazelnuts,
absolutely. And of course, the other, we have all seaports have rail and trucks that come in and out. And the trucks in particular, with the volume of those things, tracking those things is a whole other issue we'll talk about here.
Are they photographed and reported as they come in?
Yes.
Okay.
We have, but that's new. That's via a grant we got. We're just standing up our closed circuit television system, and we have another grant that we've been awarded that we're designing now to enhance it. That's new. Okay, so the layers after 9/11, it took about a year to really get some momentum on the marine side after the aviation side focus. There was a similar law passed, the Marine Transportation Security Act, about a year later. And again, we did the same things, risk assessments. But the difference here is that, again, Marine really didn't have a security structure before 9/11. It was security from the standpoint of just theft, not from terrorism. So the government had to create a bunch of regulations, and they did that. And then we had to develop, actually, facility security plans. We, believe it or not, those weren't required before, and we didn't necessarily have them. So we created those documents. We developed 24/7 points of contact with the Coast Guard. So that if something happens, we're able to contact each other. We always have somebody on call. They do as well. And again, money started to flow more in the last couple of years than right after 9/11 for the same types of things that we're doing at the airport. I mentioned Customs and Border Protection focuses on the cargo at the seaports. They have three programs with some wonderful acronyms and big words here. I'll put them in terms that I can understand. The first program there, the CTPAT, is basically the paper trail. It's what's required of all shippers before they arrive at the port to document what they're bringing, when they're bringing it, how much, and the Customs and Border Protection folks review that. And, in fact, that works because you may remember, I think it was about 3 years ago, Customs had a big media event when they did a bust on a bunch of weapons that came into Portland. The way they were able to do that is that they tracked the paperwork and they realized that a shipment that said it had fish on it wasn't in refrigerated containers. So red flags started going off. And in fact, they found weapons, firearms.
Remember, we had the great fireworks one, too.
Yes. here in Portland, the other thing they do is the VACIS program, which basically is this big thing, thing shaped like that, that goes over that can go over a container. It's actually on a vehicle, but it's portable. But it can go over a container, and it's an X-ray machine is what it is. But we only do about 5% of the containers. And, of course, it's random and it's targeted. That's about as far as I can go on that. The other thing that's not currently done here but will be in the future, we're just not there yet. We're not as big as Oakland and Seattle and Long Beach that already have these things. But these radiological monitoring reporters, and again, they're these things that they're actually fixed. And a bunch of them lined up on the marine terminal, and the vehicles drive through them, and they test for radiological emissions. And that would
bond.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that would be, and that's done at 100%. Once it's in place, we'll be doing 100% of the containers because it doesn't take a lot of time. The X-ray machine is slower because you're putting a huge three-dimensional X-ray thing over this big 40-foot container, and it takes time to slice and dice it and analyze it and see what's in there. You know, it takes a couple of seconds on a luggage at the airport. You can imagine what it takes in a 40-foot container. So 100% on the radiological doesn't slow down commerce, and that's why they can do 100%. I mentioned the Dubai AHA, which was just like the great cargo myth on the aviation side. It became public knowledge that, you know, that, oh my God, you know, the government doesn't run all the ports. Well, true. Now, what was misconstrued a little bit in the press is that the government entities, port authorities, own all the land usually, but they contract it out, lease it out, whatever you want to call it, to these private firms. That's very common. The next big thing that's coming in the marine side of things is called TWIC, Transportation Worker ID Card. We actually received a notice of proposed rulemaking, which is, you know, the federal process to say, hey, heads up, we're proposing to implement new regulations. What are your comments? And we're going to implement these things in 6 to 18 months. What the TWIC program has been in was in the ASTA legislation, the Aviation Transportation Security Act legislation. It's been around since 9/11, which is the concept is that anybody who's in the transportation field, rail, trucking, aviation, would have a card, it's like a national ID card, basically, that has a biometric component, some biometric component, be it fingerprints or iris or handprints or whatever. And we as transportation workers will be able to go from node to node and say, yep, this is Mark Crosby, and so far he's okay. So you can let him in to wherever you're going if he doesn't need to be there. The pilots, frankly, the airline pilots have been asking for this for forever because the card access systems at airports that were required 30 years ago are only good at that airport. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But they're only good. So you'll see some pilots with about a half a dozen of these things, or airline employees. But the federal government, DHS, chose to pick Marine as the first transportation venue by which they're going to try to implement this program. And frankly, the challenge is to develop a nationwide database that we can access and all the other ports can access fairly instantaneously when someone swipes or runs their card. And we don't know how they're going to do that yet. And plus the Marine side, there's a weather element that isn't as prevalent at the aviation side. Most marine terminals obviously are outside in air that has seawater, you know, has a salt element to it. So it's going to be, that's the thing to watch in the coming months is how that's implemented. We're not sure how that's going to be implemented, but we're working with the feds to give them our input on it. And what that is, again, is interoperable access control. So that'll be the big thing coming forward in the next few months on the marine side. The other thing that Ken Murphy here, as the Director of Office of Emergency Management, is the lead on and very familiar with is this Top Officials Exercise 4. There's been three previous ones. It's the largest counterterrorism exercise that the federal government sponsors to a degree in the country. They've had three of them. They've been doing about every 2 or 3 years. And Oregon, in particular, Portland area, was selected a year ago to be the next site, and along with Phoenix and Guam, but they're not. Their scenario is going to be a lot smaller than what ours are. And we're just getting into this. We just met with the federal officials over the last few days to try and get the latest. But part of the challenge there is that the federal DHS has been pulled in all these different directions post Katrina and everything. That a date hasn't been chosen yet, so we're not able to plan thoroughly yet until we get some of the basics down. What we can expect for that is, in its current format, is a big exercise with one of those weapons of mass destruction that I talked about earlier, radiological, chemical, or combinations there, biological and thereof, where it's like a 5 to 10 day event with about 10,000 participants. And this is huge, absolutely huge. And so that will be put Portland on the national and international radar screen for a while whenever this thing happens, and will take a lot of Ken and his staff's efforts in the city and us. So, my last slide here before I open up for questions is kind of a what can we do? And in summary, as I said earlier, I believe that deterrence is the best way to approach these things. Look at what your risks are and then apply more layers to push the bad people somewhere else or just deter them. Make it more difficult because the more layers there are, the more likely they are to stumble along the way, because that's how law enforcement finds bad people usually, is by stumbling upon them mm-hmm. when they trip up along the way before they actually implement something bad, like just happened with the New York thing. Also, Ken and I are really big believers on this all-hazards preparation. Some people get wound up about, we got to have a specific avian flu plan. Well, yeah, kind of. It's really infectious disease because at least we forget the SARS scare a couple of years ago. And that's where we're focusing our efforts, because we do have limited resources. They're cyclical, like I said, and reactional sometimes. We're trying to do better at when something happens, being able to pull our resources together through communication, interoperable communications and other things, mm-hmm. to get the right people in place. Because what we all have found in all the after-action reports is that the later, and you saw this in New Orleans, mm-hmm. the later you get your key people together and start reacting and solving the problem, the worse the problem exponentially becomes. So the way to prepare for that is what we always preach, which is exercise and plan to the best of your ability and the best of your funding. And then my last little sales pitch is of course, the risk assessments show this. The ports are the major logistical centers, and they're normal and during crisis times. But if we were to have an event, we saw this in New Orleans, when they were trying to deal with the saving lives, where did they go? They evacuated the Superdome and the convention center to the airport. Mm-hmm. And I've got pictures of the airport terminal there. And Roy Williams, who was the director there at the time, never envisioned that his airport would be an evacuation center. And so we at airports now and port authorities are thinking about what would happen if. We had a presentation the other day at a thing that Ken and I were at, where a guy from Baton Rouge port, which is way up the river, wasn't affected, was told by the federal government that they're going to bring a Carnival Line cruise ship in, and they're going to have 2,000 people, students, live in that ship from Tulane or LSU. Tulane, and come and live there at his port facility. And those are things we just didn't think about in the past, so we got to be cognizant of that, that our ports are the transportation nerve centers. That concludes my formal presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
When's the radiological portal monitors going to be in?
My last discussion with the Customs and Border Protection is they're hoping for this coming federal fiscal year, which would be about the next 18 months.
So it's not a manufacturing, but a budgeting issue then?
Yeah. A budgeting that they have to phase in. The big ports get them first, and then they slowly trickle down through some of the other ports.
One of the problems that we're a ship that's coming into port, is that we continue to hear that we're one of the worst ports to get in and out of. Are we making progress with, in other words, handling the trucks coming in and out? The guys complain an awful lot about the delays when they come into port.
The access as far as...
Once you enter into the port facility, it's expedite getting that container off and getting back out with an empty.
And actually, we've had some delays the last few weeks, but the reason... we've had delays is that we're building capital improvements to improve that. But part of that challenge is as we saw with the shutdown on the West Coast ports, is working with the longshoremen and negotiating their willingness to accept technology.
Right. No more need be said.
Thank you.
One question. One of the pictures that you had was the aircraft down on the cargo room, and behind it was a great big mountain that I understand is rumbling this morning. We did geology and have them tell us about what they think the risk factors are. And yesterday we had the individual in here from the federal government talking about that very issue. Do we have any idea what would happen if we had, a similar eruption explosive that occurred in the past and, Sandy River run? What would be the procedures in place, or you just basically execute the same plan throughout the other?
Depending upon, in earthquakes, and I spent some time in that big state down south for a while and reacted to some of those things. And, depends upon where it is and what the magnitude is.
Okay.
And, our big concerns from the port standpoint, besides the, if it's an ash fallout, you got ash to deal with, which obviously shuts down everything.
The good news is it shouldn't come that directly.
And if the winds are working right. We're more concerned about, the airport is built on sand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we could have some serious problems in that respect.
Liquification.
Absolutely. So the pavements, we're the highest, we got more pavement per square foot than probably as much as ODOT, but that's a big concern. And then, of course, the levees.
Exactly.
Now, we work very closely with Multnomah County Drainage District. They have a really bang-up program. Bob Eaton and Dave Hendricks, if they haven't spoken to this group, they are sharp. They've spoken with us. We include them in our planning. They've been to New Orleans post last fall and looked at what they've done wrong. And we have some good levees here, as good as you're probably going to be able to build without the huge catastrophic. So because that would obviously introduce flooding. So liquefaction is the biggest issue. In getting our pavements, we've got engineering staff trained in assessment of pavement condition.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, as a real backup, we have Hillsborough out there. If we need to get things in and out, those runways can handle most aircraft,
mm-hmm.
especially during a contingency, if necessary. And helicopters initially are going to be where you're going to get most of your response.
Right.
But actually, you're absolutely right. Liquefaction is a significant concern out there.
Well, see, one of the things that we've been interested in within this committee is, are we even thinking about preparedness? And one of the good news items relative to what we've heard is, as compared to 10 years ago, we are way out in front as far as preparedness. Because, back in those days, you would ask, well, can you talk to each other? No. Do you have a plan? No. Do you have a list of those who can intervene to help? No. And today we get answers of yes, yes, yes. And that's very encouraging for this committee.
It's not perfect,
right.
We'll all be first to admit that, but there are things in progress to make it better. I mentioned our communication center, our dispatch center. We're actually tied in with the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same system. We bought their system so that we can, every time there's a fire there, we know about it. And we're not going to do anything,
mm-hmm.
but we know. And that helps us because the airport, while we have our own police and fire departments, if there's anything significant just at the airport, we rely on mutual aid.
They're going to be coming in. Right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And the other thing that a lesson learned that from a Port Authority standpoint that's good going forward is that we've established a network amongst airports and seaports to help each other out. So, in effect, a mutual aid
mm-hmm.
within the industry, because that's what we saw down in New Orleans, which is you don't want a contractor coming in to fix your airport. If you've never met them, you don't know them, they've never been in an airport environment. You want somebody who's in the same industry, because when we were down there, we were able to get a tour of the facility within 2 to 4 hours of the whole facility and be right at home, because everything is the same that's on there. It's just in a different location.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing on the marine side. You saw that in the utility industry in Mississippi. They were wonderful about getting things going there. So we rely on that. Because if it's a regional disaster, we realize that we're not going to be necessarily the highest priority. There's going to be other priorities. So if we can get our industry cohorts to come help us, that's a good thing.
This may be something you aren't aware of, but based on what I've heard so far, I bet you know. The salvage sheet, our big pull ship, it's still there. Is there any danger that we're going to lose it? Because we've heard rumblings over the years that, it's a very expensive ship to maintain.
Dredging or?
No, this salvage sheet, this is the big pull ship.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
We'll have to get back to you on that.
Because, whenever you look at a channel as long as ours.
Right. And I'm sorry, I forgot to mention the other thing about your volcano question. Obviously, if there's a liquefaction or an earthquake, getting the river channel back up and running is going to be a huge. But because we have our own dredge,
right.
The port does. We have one of them. We have one. That's at least one good thing. But, yeah, getting the shipping channel up and running is going to be a huge, huge effort with multiple agencies and multiple ports up and down the river.
Okay.
Okay. I could just,
yes.
And this isn't going to surprise you. Legislators, what I hear most from legislators are questions about the cargo and both airport and marine cargo and how. And so I guess I'm happy to hear that somebody is thinking about the shippers on down the links.
Supply chain.
Yeah, the supply chain to rectify it so that when I'm flying in an airplane or somebody's on a boat or the trucks are pulling the containers off, that you have some assurance that bad stuff isn't in there. And if I could just be so bold as to make a personal recommendation, and that is, I think the entire world should take some lessons from the Frankfurt Airport. I have to say, I've been extremely impressed. The two times that I've been through the Frankfurt Airport, their security, not only their security, but their efficiency is incredibly amazing. I mean, not only did I have to go through several layers, as you said,
yep.
At the screening at the airport. I mean, that doesn't occur at the airport in Rome or Pierce or anywhere else I've been here. In Frankfurt, I mean, I really feel like, you know, there's no way that anyone could have gotten on that plane with anything on their bodies that wasn't supposed to be there. And so that was actually very reassuring to me. And on the efficiency side, I mean, I literally almost didn't make it to the turnstile before my luggage was there, and I was amazed. That's the only place that that's happened. So, I just really think that Frankfurt has their stuff together, and so everyone should be kind of looking at their operations.
Comment on that, dude, because I've gotten a tour of that airport. They're set up a little differently, which allows them that, which is the Fraport is actually a corporation, the entity that runs the airport. They do the security, so instead of having, we do physical security, TSA does screening, and then airline contractors do all the bags handling. All three of those functions are done by Fraport, by that entity. So there's a little bit of synergy there that they have. They have a command center that is at least twice the size of this room. It's in two parts, and one set of wall of screens is on the screening side of the passengers, and one wall is on the airline side. It's an enviable position from the standpoint of they're able to consolidate all those functions into one. Our current aviation structure doesn't allow for that, but that's one of the reasons why they've had been able to gain some efficiencies in that. And you're right, it seemed like I went through screening at least twice.
Yeah.
just to get to my plane.
Yeah, it's not just, as you're entering, and showing your ticket, it's before they even let you to the gate, you got to go through a second, more even extensive physical pat down, really. I mean, and so, I was not concerned about anyone on that plane having anything that they weren't supposed to. But, that was pretty impressive.
What Judith has just said, this last week, my sister was coming in California, so the aircraft was delayed by about an hour and a half. And so, you're in the waiting room, where everyone comes out, where they can expect me. So you know me, I've got to talk to somebody. So I'm just talking to everybody around there and asking about, delays and, what have you thought about security and everything else. And, it's a pretty good cross-section, I think, of the people that were in that building at that time. And the response was, I don't mind. I want to know, have that assurance when I get on that airplane that this thing is, in fact, secure. People are really understanding about that. I didn't think it would be quite this good, but that's good news. And the fact that we can keep moving up the level of security and the speed of what is done, the coordination factor, I think that really, we're seeing the numbers build on the number of the people that are back flying again. And I understand you guys are right back up equal to or beyond above.
We're at our all-time highs.
Yeah.
This is last year we were, and we're exceeding that even this year by 3 or 4%. So, absolutely.
Absolutely great news.
Well, I think that's true. One issue is that you can always tell how you're doing because you can have someone do it a process and then convenience them and making them angry, and another process in which they say, I understand this is good. So I think you guys are doing a good job out there based upon what I've heard. But let's be proud of those people around you.
PSA has taken a lot of hits, you know, because their new agency was formed quickly. And but I will say that absolutely, while there's, you know, definitely things that we go back and forth on and look for improvement, they have raised the level of security since before. And it's because they have higher standards that are stricter than what was in place before.
Mm-hmm.
Without getting into the public-private debate, I mean, the standards are higher, and they're doing a better job.
Better training probably all the way
absolutely
through staffing. Because that's
absolutely
what I noticed. I watched the whole operation while I was there. Was pretty impressed with it. It just seemed to be the right interval between the fact that you saw someone who was in charge working for the port and in working security, and it was just, you were thinking this is a real good mix and flow, enough that it would put someone that might be uneasy about their behavior, it might put them on edge, and that's the first you're going to spot. Okay.
And lastly, again, thank you for having me. We do have a lot of resources. Like I said, we have a lot of facilities and a lot of land in this area. If there's anything, anytime you'd want to go out and take a look at some of those things, we'd be happy to arrange that.
Sure. We'll be really glad when all the new cranes are in.
That's right. That's right. We will, too. Hopefully another one here shortly. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I was going to say, are you going to give that report?
Sure.
All right. Kind of an interesting thing, and I'll just go ahead and talk about it, since I have been politically correct already once today. And that is some of the issues that we asked about. We have information for the committee here and our unit tele security. And Judith is basically going to tell us. So with these two issues, we had a report back. The answer that we got was, probably won't make the co-chairs happy, but the answer was along the line of understandable, and the main thing we wanted for the committee was that assurance that, in fact, things are happening that are increasing security. Judith, you want to go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Mart and others, I just for the record, now, you have some information. I think it might be the last piece of your packet. It has hydroelectric information for Columbian State Snake River projects.
That is Dvorak.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I pulled up some information on Dvorak, but also following that is some information on by project, where the location is, who the owner-operator is of the various dams along the Columbia system is also attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably near the bottom of
here. Okay, got
it. And I just wanted to briefly share with you what the Army Corps of Engineers shared with me over the phone yesterday. They're not to the point where they could come and share any information publicly. They did assure me of a number of things. First of all, that all the dams are going through a process where they're looking at both policy changes for better security and physical changes to the dams that might need to happen if they need any barricades or any sort of other structures that might help in deterrence of any kind of an attack or breach of the dams. So that is moving forward. Also, they do have in place currently different levels of action that they take based on different terrorist threat levels, if you will. If they do get a word from the FBI that there has been any kind of threat to a dam on the Columbia or dams in general, then they go into a different mode, and then they won't allow transportation over the dams. You know, they don't allow people to drive over, and maybe they interrupt tours and not allow, you know, the public to go inside the dams and that sort of thing if they get a credible threat that says there might be someone out there trying to get to a dam. So we will get a report from them when these policy and perhaps physical changes get far enough along where they're able to report to us. The other thing, actually, and maybe Ken can even speak for himself on this, but I think he brought up an excellent, excellent point this morning to me, and that is the dikes and levees.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't need to be just concerned about the dams, but the
right
dikes and levees. And And he can answer your questions about this, but basically said the Army Corps still maintains some of those, but a lot of those return back to the communities for maintenance. Mm-hmm. And some areas have formed special districts to provide maintenance to those. Some are in incredible disrepair because the community doesn't have the resources to maintain. And the one legislative action, actually, that he suggested that you may wish to consider, and that is the special districts don't necessarily have the authority to tax at a level that allows them to maintain the dikes and levees. And when you think about that, because those are facilities that might not get the attention of a big dam, they might be more vulnerable and certainly would cause a lot of damage if some of those were breached intentionally or unintentionally from disrepair. So you might want to consider legislation regarding the tax and affiliated special districts for that purpose.
Well, Ken,
for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and let me just digress, if you'll allow me. The dam security issue, I think you'll find, even if they say they can't tell you everything, it's all secrets. You know, the major dams are, I think, very well protected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the Columbia and the Snake and some of the other large ones. One thing, if they do make a report that I hope they talk about, and I've taken a look at this very on a small scale, but a lot of the smaller dams that are privately owned or smaller ones for flood control that are run by the Corps, for whatever reason, I'm sure money and different things like that, have nobody. They're remotely monitored. And even though it does cause me concern, you know, remote monitoring has been defined as somebody goes, checks it once a day, or it's done by cameras, and I'm a little bit concerned about that part of the dam safety issue. Now, to the dikes and levees, I mentioned to Judith, it really is, I think, an issue, and I surely will get you some more information on this because it looks complicated. And when I started investigating it, and it came up after our January flooding events, especially in Coos County, Senator Berger should be very interested in this because her area was affected by a large dike and levee system that does have two dike and levee districts, but which I can't explain, due to some tax laws in Oregon and issues with special districts, they were not able to collect enough money from the people the dikes protected to be able to maintain the dikes and the floodgates and the different things to the appropriate level. And they were in disrepair. And then when you have a large rain event like we had in January, combined with especially ocean tides, the dikes just they can't handle it and they'll fail. And then we also in Clatsop County had a similar one where the Corps of Engineers had turned it over to the local community in 1946 and has not been touched since then. And a lot of people just don't even realize sometimes what that mound of dirt is.
And behind it, water is higher than you are.
Yeah. And people have done things to these dikes. In this case, in Clatsop County, a railroad had built a railroad across the top of it. And they were doing some repair work. But it just takes, you know, if you don't really do a lot of maintenance on them, they, you know, a good flood event or rain event will cause them to fail. And so we've asked the Corps, and in the state of Oregon, we actually have four districts from the Corps of Engineers that we have to deal with. You've got the Portland District, the Walla Walla District, San Francisco, and Sacramento districts that all touch Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
But the Portland District probably has the most, and we have a lot of dikes and levees that we're trying to establish, especially the communities where the Corps of Engineers does not have responsibility. Does the community leaders know, you know, do you know you have this dike and levee, number one? And number two, is there somebody that's charged with maintaining it? And, you know, what are the issues and problems? Because, I understand. But, you know, those are some of the things that we're looking at now that, you know, help Oregon be better prepared. Because if we can know about them and deal with them ahead of time, then we might prevent some future disaster.
Again, I personally experienced that. We had one time someone dynamited a structure that was under construction and put about 1,800 acres of our farm underwater, big time underwater, and flooded probably 5,000 or 6,000 acres. It could have been a city. And, in fact, one of the reasons they did what they did was the fact that they didn't want to get him down to the next town where that the flood might have put the city underwater. But so let me see if we can get you straight, because as far as legislation, we might be looking at SETI establishing new standards and then possibly a backup system for if they cannot, if they don't have the ability, say, with a major fire cap or something like that.
Sure, George. Okay. Yeah, I got to do some more study, and I'm frankly kind of ignorant on the subject. I just ran into it. I knew we had dike and levee problems, but I had not experienced this event in Coos Bay because we had the leaders of the dike and levee districts come testify and met with the county commissioners and the leadership of the county on, because I was coming down there. We had money from the presidentially declared disaster, and we had hazard mitigation money, and we wanted to. There was about two dozen homes that were pretty much flooded all the way to their rooftops, from the January rain event. And then that's where we ran into it, because these districts testified that they could collect a certain amount of money, but it really wasn't enough to do the things that you need to do, because it's not just necessarily about that berm of dirt either. There's floodgates, many different issues, removing weeds, pumps. And they could collect a certain amount of money, but they had problems with special district rules and some tax laws in Oregon that prevented them as a district, as I remember the conversation, from collecting enough money from the homeowners to be able to do those things to make sure that the dike or levee was in proper maintenance.
Do we have a good inventory of all of those districts and all of the levees and the acreage involved and that sort of thing?
Chair George, Representative March, we have a pretty good inventory. We're trying to validate it at this time, because once this event in Coos Bay and Clatsop County, we requested the Corps, to provide us, their database based on their records, and we're going through the process now with each city or county where they're located to try and validate, is it all still valid, especially who owns it and who's responsible for maintaining it is the critical issue.
And then the next critical issue, I guess, would be the current condition. For example, ODOT does a rating of bridges from 0 to 100, 100 being the best, 0 being the worst. And for example,
right.
Selwood's number 2, and I don't drive on it. But so do we have a rating system for all these levees and systems?
Chair George, Representative March, only the ones that the Corps maintains. The ones that are privately owned or nobody knows anything about, there's nothing out there.
Have we done a lot with land use to encourage people not to build in the floodplains, not to build in debris flow areas? What about this issue? I mean, do we have folks that are continuing to build in areas that are actually only protected by that levee system?
Chair George, that whole issue, we've done better and better, but, in my opinion, as long as it means tax base and economics for communities, and there's no, and this is a subject that my office has talked about with the Department of Lands Conservation, and is there's no requirement to disclose the hazards to a public or private entity that's going to build. So if you're going to build on the side of a hill that is clearly scientifically documented that it's a landslide, there's absolutely nothing we can do to stop them. And there's no requirement to make sure that that owner of that facility or piece of earth really recognizes that they're doing it.
But we do have a debris flow. Well, we dealt with that a few years ago, because that came through my committee.
Yeah. No, we do.
And you realize that you could give somebody an option. You may have one on your property, an area that would be out of that floodplain or that area that would go under if the levee broke. But when I started talking to Judith about dam security, one of the things that I had heard was that initially there was security, not security issues, but potential that if Rorschach was to go, that wall of water, you know, because it is such a tall dam with a lot of water in a small area, which means velocity, that in fact, you know, would be over the top of this dam. So we were thinking about, if some event like that occurred, would you in fact be able to, because most of our dams, you know, they're really not the water storage that are on the Columbia. They're basically just to hold up a little elevation to get the barges up and to generate power. So do you have enough storage capacity to mitigate that massive flow of water coming before it got to Portland? And when I was up there in Idaho looking at that dam, I was in Clarkston and Lewiston during the time that the maximum water flow was occurring. So all of the dams were monitoring and releasing the water just to keep it under control. And I'm downtown looking up, you know, probably 15 to 20 feet to the water in the river. And you're thinking, boy, they really maintain that dike system, you know, in Clarkston and Lewiston, and you better maintain it. Because you have all those rivers coming in there, and then you have, you know, the possibility that it's got to get out down the channel of the Snake River. So I think that particularly in coastal areas, I've noticed the same thing. I just saw all of this stuff falling into disrepair and wondered if it wouldn't reach a point in which the state would have to say, okay, here are the standards for maintenance. We'll have to have some authority or maybe dollars at the state level to come in and say, if it's impossible for a community to do it, we'll do it. I mean, similar to what we do with water and sewer treatment plants, where we may be able to help them with long-term financing or something like that.
Yeah, and Chair George, and that's why I mentioned it to Judith, because to me that's one of those areas in what I would consider mitigation as part of being better prepared is, you know, that it's something that we can as a state look at and try and address the problems, because I know just from my short amount of studying so far since January this year, we've got a lot of dikes and levees out there that are not owned by anybody, and they're just sitting there. And some of them, you know, really have no impact in too many communities, but some are pretty critical. And I really believe a lot of people don't even realize, you know, what that mound of dirt. I'm telling Judith earlier, the folks that drive down Marine Drive probably have no clue what that mound of dirt does.
Yeah.
So I think it's something, and I'll get you a bunch of information. I think it bears looking at, for at least to look at it legislatively, that there might be something we can do, if nothing else, to help those cities or owners that may have a special district to try and do something for them.
They may not even have the capacity to actually analyze the condition that they're in.
A lot of them don't, because it generally takes a geotechnical engineer.
And, you know, as you started to talk about that, I glanced out the window, and I remember back in the floods just a few years ago that we were putting pilings and plywood. Right along the edge of that river right there.
I still have the instruction packet on how to do the plywood.
This man knows how to be prepared.
Really?
Hang on to what you have that worked before.
What agency should be the one in charge of maintaining this list and maybe in developing some sort of assessment of the status of each of these levees?
Chair George, Representative March, I think it should be maybe a combination of agencies, and I'm going to guess a little bit here. I think the Corps of Engineers should be one of them, and then maybe the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I would have to do a little bit more research on that, but I think there should be some co-ownership. I know the Corps of Engineers, you know, they're only going to deal with those that they have responsibility for, but I think, you know, combining the efforts between a federal agency and maybe a state agency or whatever, you know, you can combine resources and help each other, because in a lot of cases, you know, some of those dikes and levees are self-supporting with each other. You might have one that's not owned by the Corps that could still mess up a core dike or levee. And so, and I think it's good to, and part of that is back to good public education with our city and county elected and appointed officials of knowing that they do have this. What are their options to try and maintain it? What are their options if something does happen? Because we found in a lot of cases, the Corps of Engineers, in an event, they do not have to have a declaration of emergency from the president. They have what they call a emergency measures powers where they can come in, and we did this in Coos Bay where it happened, where they could bring in contractors and they bring in rock and dirt to try and shore up the problem, you know, to at least save lives and protect property until they can come to a long-term solution. But I think some co-ownership between federal and state there, you know, to help each other.
The problem in the Sacramento Delta is
huge. I'm just thinking about that. They were in panic mode, and they had a reason to be. Because I can remember back in the 50s and 60s, those dikes were very well maintained. And I drive along or fly now, and I look down, I go, ooh, that doesn't look like they're being maintained the way they used to. All the way up, that is not only the Sacramento Delta area, but all the way up the San Joaquin River. I mean, we're going clear back up. If you remember, you at one time, you could take a boat from San Francisco to Bakersfield. And it had to be a fairly shallow bottom if you went out basically into the Tulare Lake bed and you went out through that country. Those were real cases. In fact, when I was a child growing up down in that country, I used to play. We had a great area to play. And one day I said to my dad, "What is this anyway?" And he said, "Well, this is a flood stream that would develop during high flood time. It actually came right down through the middle of the town." Today, there is no question because about 30 years ago, they thought it was if they would have a breach in the dike that's up above, that in fact would have rechanneled right down through the middle of these two towns. And so most people don't have any idea that the hazard is still there, depending on one thing, and that's the security and stability of that dike system. And so, you know, and we have similar conditions in this area.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, me included, really do not understand. I mean, the dikes and levees across this entire nation are very critical to protecting our communities. And, you know, I just don't think we understand the severity of, you know, how important it is to keep those maintained and protected because, you know, it doesn't happen often, but as we've seen with Hurricane Katrina and the ones in the Sacramento Valley, you know, and I know even from the Mississippi River flooding, all of that, the Red River flooding in North Dakota, and, you know, that was part of that was dike and levee issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and we have to understand that old-timers were not stupid. You know, they recognized the problem. They decided if we're going to build here, we've got to make provision for the security. And it's kind of like we're reinventing an old wheel here and just coming back and saying, alert, you want to be prepared for this because we know that if you, a couple of times here in Oregon, if we would have had another week of rain, it would have been totally out of control. And this area down here in downtown Portland would have been underwater. And we already know what can happen with a little flood right behind us out here. That's where it's
Grand Forks.
And a lot of the areas in which we could have off main channel flow now have been filled in. And so that relief channel is actually gone. And that's kind of what I was alluding to down in California. Many of the off channel relief are now blocked. And the city is sitting in the middle of it. And you never think about it. You know, you may be. Here's the river, and here's the town, and the town's above the river. But up here, upstream, the town is down below the level of the river because of the elevation drop. And you're thinking, you know, that's really something that we should make preparation for and maintain the whole system because it's, as we're finding in New Orleans, it's much cheaper to maintain it than it is to replace a city.
Absolutely.
Okay, so... Ken, right now, you're kind of the person that's watching this issue because...
Yeah, it's Chair George, to me, that's just another one of my responsibilities is to weed out any potential problem that this state can face if it harm our citizens or visitors. I wish I would have been working on a long time ago, but I just, you know, when I ran into the Coos
being a classic issue. You know, I just, you know, the bright light went on. I said, who does maintain these things? And part of that, too, is, you know, through my office and the federal grants I get, especially, I'm trying to move or buy out all the people in the Coos Bay area that were affected by this, because it's happened before. They have documented history, and, you know, it's part of my job. Well, it is. It is, because even the federal government, you know, over the years has realized that people that constantly lived in documented areas that are flooding, especially, you know, and they've gone back through history and tracked this, where they've given the homeowner or replaced it three or four times, and they live in the exact same spot each time. So
nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed, and so the answer is, you know, we're going to buy you out, turn it into a park or a greenway or whatever the case may be, just like we've done. And we've done a lot of work down in Tillamook. Just had a grand opening of the new Safeway that we moved off of 101 to the upper level of Tillamook. And that should have been done 10 years ago, but as you can imagine,
I've been there when it's going by.
It takes time to convince, you know, business owners. We've moved a motel, moved a lot of things. Other things we've elevated, but some things, you know, that we wanted to try and physically move. So that's what we'll do in the Coos Bay area. I think there's 11 homeowners, and we have money under the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program that you get from a disaster to either elevate the homes or give them the opportunity to buy out their property so they can move somewhere else.
Yeah, there are things that can be done. I can remember homes along the river over in Santa Cruz, California, where the homeowners, because once in a while when that river would go, you couldn't believe the flow. I mean, there's just an amazing amount of water. And what they did is they literally just took their homes and put them up on top of pillars. And sometimes it made you nervous to be in that house where you're watching that water go by and thinking, I hope they secured the base of this thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, that can't be done.
It makes a big difference. We've done a lot of that on the Siletz River. You know, I think, don't quote me on this, I can get you some accurate numbers. We've elevated 54 homes as the Siletz, from the Siletz where it runs into the bay up the river, and then working diligently since 1996, literally, and they've had quite a few flooding events there with Lincoln County and the Siletz tribe to, you know, really public education campaign for all those homeowners, you know, that, you know, with mountains of statistical proof and data and pictures and testimonials by previous homeowners where elevating it, your home by 20 feet or whatever the case may be makes all the difference in the world, whether your home will be usable or non-livable. And so,
as you know, there's been so much reporting on, you know, the disaster of the giant tsunamis. And, of course, one of the things on the coast that you recognize that we only have a few of our hoteliers who are actually thinking in terms of putting the parking underneath. And the idea is when that wave comes that it, you're able to allow that flow to go through, the energy to be passed right through the bottom of the building. You know, those kind of things can be done. You really need parking anyway. And to think about, you know, a little bit better view, not such a problem. And when we toured OSU's research station, that was one of the things we talked about, placement of buildings and getting that area for the energy to extend itself through the bottom of the building without impacting the structure itself. When you watch those massive flows of debris and human bodies, the thing that you were impressed with is there were some structures that almost were, they were intact.
Yep.
And damage down below, but minor damage. Others were totally decimated. There was nothing left of the ground and concrete. So, okay. Well, let's see. Is there any more?
Okay. I was just going
to...
Yeah.
Umatilla.
Yeah. Okay. I apologize. This is kind of a last-minute thing, and I didn't bring any laptop.
Don't worry about it.
But if you don't mind, I've got a much bigger copy.
Oh, do you? Okay. So we have a 100%.
Oh, okay.
All right, great.
Yeah. should actually bring an overhead projector with acetate.
Yeah,
really go back in time.
Everybody laughs at mine, but I still grab it once in a while because so many times a doggone, you know, PowerPoint, it fails like an old 16-millimeter film. You know, like, what's going on? But anyway, this works perfect.
Chair George, before I get started, I do want to offer, we do have a very good earthquake and volcano plan for Mount Hood if you're interested in seeing a copy.
Mm-hmm.
It's one the state of Washington and the state of Oregon collaborated on. And yes, the mountain has been rumbling, but that's pretty normal. Actually,
that's
it rumbles quite a bit.
Yeah. A friend of ours lives right below Shasta. Her house must sit on a fault, because she said every day, a little bit of movement.
And we're not too far from finishing a really good plan for the Three Sisters.
So. These things have a lot of activity out there.
Yeah, well, they do. All right, Chair Jordan, representing March. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy, the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I'm going to give you an overview of the Chemical Stockpile Emergency Preparedness Program brief that was given 2 days ago out in Pendleton. And the slides say Chris Brown. He's my program manager out there that works for me in my office there. And talk a little bit about this program and how it affects, you know, the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. I just wanted to cover here on the second slide, this really is, and I want to say before I go into any depth on this is a program that's been going since 1989, and I use it as a good example of how we should be doing a lot of things in the state of Oregon, even dealing with Homeland Security, because these two communities in Marl and Umatilla County, Benton County, Washington, and the two states, they have gone through years and years of trial and error, and granted, they've had the money from the federal government to do it, but I think they invented the wheel, so we shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel in a lot of areas, because what they're doing to protect the citizens from a chemical accident out there are a lot of the similar things as Mr. Crosby mentioned about being prepared for all hazards. So, anyway, just to highlight this, again, I think it's been a very good, unique partnership between the federal government, the two states, the Confederated Tribe of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and the local jurisdictions in Marl and Umatilla County and all their cities. It has a common goal to prepare and enable the communities to protect their residents in the unlikely event of a chemical emergency. It is one of seven remaining chemical stockpile sites in the nation that are in the process or have completed destroying the chemicals. This particular chemical plant, hopefully, and it's very hard to predict exactly when, will be done burning their chemicals sometime between 2011 and 2013. And right now they're burning the worst of the worst, GB and sarin. And so they're hopefully will be done with those by 2008 in their process. In this particular area, as I mentioned, we have the two states, the three counties, eight cities, and there's 250 first responders and 35,000 citizens living in what we call the emergency or immediate response zone, and I'll go into those zones a little bit more and how they've done, and that's a way to protect the citizens better. The local government is initially responsible, as you are both well aware, for implementing their own emergency management program. And then this is funded through the Department of Defense, through Homeland Security, direct to the state, and then to the communities between the two states and the two counties. And since 1989, we've received about $101 million over that time to improve things out there so that they can respond to an event. On the page three, I think it is, the map of the emergency zones, really just wanted to kind of orient it. This is part of a way of identifying the most critical areas nearest the depot that would be affected by any type of an event. and it's based upon wind patterns, and as you can see, each one is identified by an alpha numerical category, and that makes it much easier than using the incident command system to pick certain areas and how we're going to react to those. The potential area of concern is really where we ask the people to take a protective action is in with a 20-mile radius of the depot fence. And let me regress and say, and this is just the way the government works, if the event happens, which it will, inside the fence, the Army has responsibility to try and stop it and deal with it inside the fence. Once it gets outside the fence, it's our problem. And I will say the communities out there in the Army have worked very, very well together to support each other, because we want to help the Army stop it before it gets out, and they want to help us if it gets out. And so it's been a very good cooperative effort. And we're working on that.
Reverse those big windmill powers.
Yeah. Well, as you can well imagine, out there in that desert environment, boy, I tell you, the wind can blow in any given direction every couple seconds. They've done some testing out there, quite extensive testing of the wind patterns, and it's just all over the map. But it predominantly blows more to the north and to the east, generally speaking, I think, on a 365-day average. As you look at the map, as I said, within 20 miles of the depot fence is our biggest concerns. And for the planning purposes, we divide this area into three larger zones. So the pink area is called the immediate response zone. Those are the people that are closest to the fence, have the greatest chance of being affected by any kind of an event. And then the protective action zone, which is shown in green, that's the area that we can advise citizens and businesses and things like that where they could take some sort of protective action, either by evacuation, primarily evacuation, or inside some sort of building, you know, to protect them. And then the marine zone, which is really a 40-mile stretch of the Columbia River that we have to take into account, that we work with the Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard, and everybody with to protect the traffic on the river. And so we've got six Oregon communities that are affected by the chemical depot that we work with. And the other factors that we look at in dealing with this, and this is how we would really break down any city. Between this entire area, the schools, there's five school districts with 31 facilities that we work with. Hospitals, the Good Shepherd Medical Center is located in the immediate response zone, so that's a concern, but we still have to use that to our benefit to protect the citizens. And, of course, transportation corridors. You have, obviously, Interstate 84 and Interstate 82 coming out of Washington State that are critical. And then you have the railroad at the Southern Depot border and the Union Pacific Rail Line there. And then we also have the Hinkle Rail Yard, which is a major switching facility that we have to be concerned with. And then, of course, the river traffic going up and down the Columbia River. And
are there instructions, you know, for a train operator, for a person in a tub that, you know, that has a load, that if anything goes wrong, they're immediately notified by radio? They immediately secure that vehicle, right? Whether it's rail or...
Chair George, I'll be candid with you. I don't think we've had any difficulties with marine traffic. Rail traffic, they're a little bit more independent.
Put into mind.
Yeah, we have notification systems. Obviously, we can control the highways much easier. And the Coast Guard has been very supportive of making sure the river is immediately shut down. But rail, we work with them pretty heavily, and mainly it's cargo trains that pass through that area. So I don't think there'll be a problem. But they're interested in moving commerce and making money. And sometimes they're not too concerned because they feel that their rail line may not necessarily be effective. And they said they would wait and see which way the wind's blowing.
So. Now, looking at the map, and you look at the, you know, the bigger cities like Princeton, but also they're assuming that outside of that border, that green border, that we're looking at such a dissipation level at Tri-Cities and that kind of thing, they're not really in any kind of danger.
Chair George, you're absolutely right. Based upon scientific results, the experiences of the Department of the Defense, engineers, scientists, that Sarin, VX, GB, the dissipation level based on the wind and they would eventually either drop to the ground or evaporate and become ineffective.
And that's the good news about desert conditions.
It is.
Cold in the winter and hot in the summertime. Yep.
Yep. And in a lot of cases, too, they've also learned one of the things that they do, you know, if there is some sort of an explosion at the devil, let's just say with fire and those kind of things, a lot of that stuff is destroyed simply by the fire.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of times a large amount of that may not necessarily get off the coast.
There was a lot of concern initially as to whether or not burning stuff was going to do it. Now, I talked to enough people to tell me this isn't burning like you would be thinking about burning. And one friend of mine that is an expert in this area tells me absolutely that there's nothing left of the original chemical blend when that's through. I mean, it is totally destroyed. And as much as you can take a molecule of anything and make it go to nothing, this is as close as you're going to get.
Yeah, Chair George, I mean, this is, I surely don't understand the science of it, but I think this is probably credit to our scientists and the different people that develop these technologies, that these systems, furnaces, and the way they do it, absolutely, they've taken into account every possibility, the different types of issues with residue, multiple systems of any type of steam or things like that, that it's gone through an incredible amount of filtration, you know, and so, and it went through some very, very rigorous testing under permit with the Department of Environmental Quality here in Oregon, and so it's quite a feat of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the right thing to do, and I think they did it properly, and they're doing it safely.
Well, I'm looking at the modules that they actually, the sealed container, the cylinder. That was kind of what we thought initially. That's going to have to be some structure because you're going to have the risk of explosion, but, you know, the main thing is you're going to contain it in such a way that at least you can, you know, protect the public around there. Is that a secure way out to the burner when they put it on the truck?
Yeah.
Did you guys talk about that?
Well, I wasn't at it, but I can tell you that the security out there, it is very, very secure in military installation.
All right, because Representative Boquist and I had very much concern going clear back to the 60-minute report in 1998.
Well,
and,
the 1998 report, I think that was a little bit more about the ability of the off-post community and how they were going to respond. But the military's actions to secure the post and the facility are very significant, you know, both with physical security features and non-physical electronic measures, you know, that will detect any type of, you know, insecure action. And the workers, when they move the munitions, everything is, you know, there's a plan put in place exactly by name, who's going to move what from what igloo with what equipment. It's tracked minute by minute. From the minute it's put on in the igloo to a forklift or a truck and moved into the incinerator, every minute, every action is tracked. So, and those are all necessary points. If something does happen or go wrong, that we know exactly what the situation was so they can react to it.
We've watched over the years the military has done things and they wouldn't really notify folks that something had gone wrong. Do we have the absolute assurance that they're going to notify us? For example, if I'm backing up that forklift and I bump into something and I stole some, what is it, M58 or whatever that one?
M55.
That in fact a community is going to immediately be notified that there may be a risk?
Yes, Chair George. We've, in all the years that I've been involved with this, we've always had a a good relationship, a good understanding, and, they, and there's never been anything to cause doubt that anything that happens, that the military facility lets, we have a, I think, a very good, secure, functional system, even if it has nothing to do with burning chemicals, even if there is a leaker, as we call them, in the igloos, whether it's a vapor leak or an actual leak of the fluid, my office, everybody in that entire community, and also the state of Washington is immediately notified. Even if it's a vapor leak inside of an igloo, we know instantly, you know, what the problems are. So I can tell you with confidence that we would know immediately anything.
Great. I noticed that in, within the booklet here, they show the students hurriedly getting onto onto the school bus and making their way out. Welcome.
No, I, Chair George, I will tell you this. The children in the schools over there are probably some of the best-trained children in the state.
Right.
Because they constantly train. A lot of the schools have overpressurized facilities, too, where the kids can actually go into the... A lot of them are in the gym, and they have cots and food, and it's an overpressurized room that seals. So you're protected.
And filters the air coming in for pressurizing.
Yeah. And, but then the other one, of course, is they constantly train, which is good for fire evacuation and everything else, on how to evacuate, and they work with the parents, and they really do it all the time. And they're just excellent, excellently trained kids over there and how they deal with those type of emergencies. So it's very encouraging to watch the children and the school systems over there.
Well, I think this is some of the area in which we can maybe smile a little bit about, because we had plenty of concern back in 1998, 1999 about what was happening.
We did.
The idea that what in the community I don't believe was prepared. I know what I would have been doing if I lived over there. And but today it really appears that they're
they really
to
are,
deal with it.
And it's validated constantly, and it's graded exercise each year. And there's the managers from the cities and the counties, and my office, we're constantly maintaining systems, checking them to make sure, you know, and that's why I use this particular group of people and what they do as good examples, you know, of as a good model for, you know, a lot of the things that we should just do as a normal daily routine.
We're going to talk about this later, but the, you know, the governor just had some comments about frozen, and you know, we've all been concerned about all the fuel rods still being stored there, and that same kind of security and alert and notification system, is it pretty much in place for Trojan or something?
Yes, Chair George, yeah, no, we, you know, I think a lot of people don't think Trojan's a threat since they imploded the tower, but, you know, and a lot of people don't pay attention sometimes to, you know, that there are still fuel rods there, but the system of notification and working with the Department of Energy here in Oregon is all in place, you know, to make sure, just as it is for the Hanford facility, because Oregon could be affected by a problem in Hanford, so we have good systems of warning and alert for the citizens.
Is the containment unit below the level of the river, where if a, for a back flood or something?
Treasurer, I do not know, but I'll find out for you.
I know that there was preparation made for that kind of thing. In other words, if something goes wrong with our water holding structure, is if you have a backup, maybe three or four of them?
Yeah, more than one.
And we really like more than one. More than one is a good thing.
I prefer more than one in my business. Just to finish out on here, one of the things that we've noticed, and this is part of Oregon's growing economy and people, the growth in those two counties in Oregon have increased significantly over the years. Walmart, of course, moved a distribution center into Hermiston. Hermiston is one of the fastest growing cities in the state of Oregon. A good, large, agricultural-based economy over there. So that's the good news. The more bad side of that is we've got to work twice as hard in a lot of areas, you know, to really deal with it, because not only in protecting lives and things, but, you know, the economy becomes more and more important to make sure it's back up and running. So And then, of course, the one thing I will add to this that adds double protection to the citizens is they get additional money and training and efforts because of Hanford.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can, they're in the radius of a large event for Hanford, so there's money and time spent to protect citizens.
$100 million, a lot of money.
Well, they get extra money.
They get extra money
for that. Not much, but still, are they? You know, they receive training and information on what to do. If Hanford takes place. On the next slide, number four, I just wanted to, reinforce, that the system out there is tested and validated on a very consistent basis. And you can see the federal benchmarks that they take a look at, administrative support. You may find that odd, but it's very important when you think about some of the different things to maintain all the systems. Alert notification system. They have a very robust system of sirens, tone alert radios in people's homes and businesses to warn everybody, all focused through dispatches and 911 centers and that type of thing, and then co-located with ODOT reader boards on the highway, not just in that area. The reader boards, even up here in Portland, will tell of a chemical event and cause you to divert. And data processing, communication, coordination plans, emergency operation centers that are tested to make sure they're functional and do what they're supposed to, have a robust exercise program, medical program, personnel, that really looks at, do you have the right people, are they qualified, and protective action strategy. That really talks about, making sure that the workers are protected and making sure that strategies to keep people in their homes, remove them from their homes, overpressurization of schools, that you have all of those strategies in place to protect the citizens for any possible event. Because depending on the chemical, actually, it's safer to stay in your home and put some duct tape and plastic. I always hate to say those things, but it's true. And others, it's not necessarily good. Over time, it will seep into your home, and it's better to leave your home. So, you have those different strategies, based on what it is. And, of course, my favorite one, public outreach and education. Huge program out there because it's all about making sure people are aware of the hazards they face. And that's a very robust program. It's about $500,000 a year. And it's a constant blitz in the media, constant things that go in your phone books, your utility bills. It's going to public events, county and city fairs, newspaper ads, teaching the public about what the risks they face and do you know how to protect yourself.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
I've always thought that this is a model for it. Do the public health officials out there detect any higher levels of stress within that community, or because of the fact that they believe that they're prepared, that they're probably properly running normal? Has anybody realized that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Judith and I have talked about that on several occasions. I personally feel, and Senator Gordley's efforts here in Multnomah County, to make sure that everybody had a plan in place, to me is more of a reassuring. You feel comfortable if you think there's a backup to wherever you are and you put the cancer in.
I do not know if anybody's actually studied, and I noticed one of the things in the future is about the mental health issues. I can tell you just from anecdotal, a lot of times the public education people out there and the outreach, they'll go out and survey the members of the community, and somewhat of a mixed reaction, but most of them are, they know about it and they feel safe because they've been taught about what's being done by the elected and appointed officials and the first responders. And I hate to admit this, there's still a certain percentage of the population still does not know that it's out there, but I think that's human nature.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think
they see everybody else doing something, they follow along.
Yeah, that's just part of our life. People are busy and sometimes miss things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but my sense is in the 6-plus years that I've been working with this is the majority of the community that has been stable residents, not necessarily mobile residents, feel pretty comfortable and just in the last few years, because everybody has been very good about opening up to the community and the citizens and making sure that every event the public is welcome to and everything, so that they can actually see what's being done. They have a wonderful, what they call an outreach office in Hermiston that has all kinds of educational materials, show you how the rockets are built and how they're destroyed and what they look like, you know, so people have some familiarity and, you know, feel comfortable about it.
One question before we go any further. Because of the model we have out here and the experience we have, do you believe that our local responders, and you saw me the first hearing and asked the question to state police, you know, have we equipped our cars with protection? And the answer is just enough to get the car back out of the way. Do we need to be looking more at that where we have, if you look at Israel, for example, everybody in that place is prepared. It's not only first responders, but it's everybody else. And you're thinking, okay, that's affordable. They could make it work. Do you think we need to move beyond that, particularly in areas, you know, the chlorine spill along the rail, that type of thing, for some preparation? Or is this just a little bit too much too early?
Chair George, it may be a little bit too much too early, but what we can do is go out there and determine, especially in our first responders. Now, I'm fairly confident with the fire that they have protection for the most part, and our hazmat teams that really will protect them. I guess I don't have a confidence in law enforcement that, you know, that man or woman that's in law enforcement, you know, in the trunk of their car,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's pretty full with lots of things, you know, but, you know, for those kind of things, you know, in our society today, like we were talking about chlorine, infectious diseases, terrorism, nowadays just having a gas mask may not necessarily be, you know, the holy grail to have in your trunk. And so, but it is something that is still needed. But I'm not sure I could confidently say, you know, what is the status of our first responders really out there? You know, do they have adequate protection, at least, like you said, Senator George, to back the car out of the way? You know, even if it's a face mask or a gas mask or something, you know, to give them initial protection, because that's one of the problems we've seen even with September 11th terrorist attacks, is the, you know, the good Samaritans and the professional first responders just running in there to save people's lives, and now they're the ones suffering from very chronic illnesses, you know, dealing with the dust and some of the things mm-hmm. that were there. So I think there's things that we still can do to make sure the first responders are better protected.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and good morning. Mm-hmm. Let me first apologize to my chair and my colleagues. Thank you, Mr. Murphy, for my Mr. Murphy, it's always good to see you.
To see you, too, Senator.
So very much appreciate your leadership and all of the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Lot
to do. Job security.
A couple of questions. Well, you mentioned mental health just briefly, and I wanted to give you a resource.
Mm-hmm.
There's a woman that I've become aware of. Her name is Becky Childs, and she works with the Oregon Advocacy Center, perhaps in a volunteer capacity. But I know that she's put together a document that describes and defines what people living with mental health challenges need to do in order to be prepared for an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great working document.
Okay.
We pass it on to folks in the family.
Okay.
Folks in our health department to take a look at it. But I think that it would be great if you could connect with the advocates.
Like to see it.
I also have a question about the federal benchmarks that we're looking at, the 12 benchmarks. As you're talking about them and as we're looking at them, are we to understand that these are all things that are in place?
Yes.
Not easy to develop, but they're all things that
are. Chair George, Senator Gordy, no, these have been in place. They were a requirement of the Department of Environmental Quality permit before they could actually start what we call trial agent burns to see if the incinerator actually even worked. And it was also part of, at that time, Governor Kitzhaber, you know, before he would sign off, you know, that the community had demonstrated and was prepared, you know, for any type of chemical emergency.
And then another question, different subject. Can you talk to us about the mechanics of shutting down an interstate like 84? If we had to do that, what would that involve? You know, the scenes from
Hurricane Katrina?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The long, large attacks, you know, attacks about people's personal needs, the need for fortifying, for the people who have health emergencies, that kind of thing. What kind of thinking and planning goes into planning for that possibility?
Chair George, Senator Gordley. I'm not sure I can cover all of the mechanics of it, because I know the Department of Transportation here in Oregon has some very, very good and wonderful plans on how to deal with that, and especially here in the Chemical Stockpile Program. You know, we have an alternate route, and the mechanics per se, I've heard both sides of the story. It's really easy to shut a freeway down, and on the other side, of course, it is really hard, but I think in you know, times of emergencies and when there's life and property at risk, you know, I'm very confident in talking to the Department of Transportation, and especially like in the Oregon State Police, that, you know, we can immediately close those things. As we do here with the Chemical Stockpile Program, we've pre-arranged agreements with the Oregon Department of Transportation where we shut down the freeways, we close ramps, you know, to specifically divert traffic in certain patterns, and the part that I'm not sure I can talk to intelligently to give you good answers, but I can later, is the mechanics of, you know, if you do have an event where, and let's just use Hurricane Katrina, where you had a contra flow on one of our freeway systems, you know, and how to address, because when you do something like that, or the freeway is backed up, as I'm sure all of us are well aware of, you create a city. And it has the same requirements, latrine facilities, food facilities, water, toys for children. If you've ever had the opportunity to be helped by the Oregon Department of Transportation Comet trucks, you will find those kind of things inside those trucks, toys, games, you know, some food, different things like that to help people that are stranded and when there's traffic accidents, you know, and the traffic's backed up. But I do not know the technical matters. I'm confident in telling you that shutting down a freeway and having these contra flow plans are well addressed and I think easy to do. I think what's difficult is then educating and making sure that the public realizes, you know, what's happening so that they can use that freeway system in the reverse mode.
So then that becomes, your comments suggest that should become part of the public outreach and education component of your specific.
And it should be for the whole state. I mean, in Eastern Oregon, they do that as part of their public education program, and they target it in specific areas, like Hermiston is one of the most important because it's a larger population area, very close to the depot, and they have a very specific evacuation plan for the city of Hermiston, which changes. They have an agreement with the city and the Department of Transportation to change the signal light system, contraflow certain routes within the city, and, you know, to move traffic in certain directions, again, based upon what the prevailing wind is at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, you know, that, is, again, is an example for any of our communities, you know, to really, you know, to say you have an evacuation plan is easy, but it's very complicated. You know, just even the traffic piece, when you think about the city of Portland, huge undertaking to really analyze, because you always have to keep in mind whatever plan you write, the people may not do what you think you want them to do. And so you have to be nimble and light on your feet, so to speak, you know, to have options and good messaging. And I think that's where public outreach and education comes in, because you can start at least getting in people's minds or something that they can read and make them think about, you know, here are some of the options that you have. You know, if we were to do this on Interstate 84 or Interstate 5, and if you can't do that, here are some other major road arteries in this particular area that you could use.
I appreciate your comments very much. We're sitting in the tribal district right now because I-5 running through it, and then Representative Martin as well as I-84 and 205 will always think about in terms of the emergency.
It occurred to me, we were up there in Vancouver Island in Comox. One of the things that we heard from relatives up there was that when 9/11 occurred, that massive long runway that they have, all kinds of aircraft were diverted there, particularly the heavies. And so the whole community rallied around. But the main thought was that you had with air, you had to get them on the ground. Here, it seemed to me would be a very similar thing that you would want to, first of all, make sure that you interrupted any further flow into the gorge, keeping them in the city, and then those who were along the way, not stopping them on the freeway, but actually getting them to the nearest safe city and getting them there, because, you know, there's always the Walmart and the Lowe's and everybody else who have the big parking lots, and you have food service and everything there, and it would make the most sense. You know, if that's built into the plan, I'm sure that they've already done that.
In some areas, I mean, it's not not everywhere totally built into the plan, but, you know, nowadays, I think we talked just briefly about in the earlier presentation with Mr. Crosby about airports becoming shelters. Well, in my book, everything in the state of Oregon is a shelter if we need it. And you have to think that way because in a disaster, things become chaotic, and what you thought you might have available may not necessarily be available, but you do have to take in consideration. So some areas have really worked with that. I think probably the area maybe that we haven't done enough work in is working with those private business partners because they, as we learned with Hurricane Katrina, they have just wonderful resources.
Yeah.
People we don't even think about. And I mentioned this before, one of the people I work with a lot is Intel. Now, why would I work with a manufacturer of chips? Well, they've got some of the most robust emergency preparedness programs because, this is probably not a current accurate figure, it costs them $10,000 a minute to be shut down.
Right.
So they have some of the most robust programs. They have a mobile response team. They have extra level A chemical suits. They have tremendous resources, not to mention big buildings and parking lots, that they could bring to bear in the community if it doesn't affect their manufacturing capability. So I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done with the private sector, because there's a lot of unique things other than the Walmarts and Lowe's and the Intels that we just don't realize. You turn a corner in your neighborhood and you go, I didn't know that was there. And it becomes a resource. And so I think we need to take a hard look at those. And I guess what I'm saying is you simply have to use everything in your community that you possibly can. And I think my experience, most people are very willing, if you sit down ahead of time and talk to them and talk about the issues, because they're more than willing to help during a disaster.
Well, you saw how pleased when this committee was in the full joint committee, when ODOT said that they had actually prepared that list for all of the contractors, in other words, scattered throughout the state, who would in fact have already been notified and a part of the plan to respond to emergency. And, I think there needs to be absolutely a delegation of authority. If you see the problem, you're a trusted contractor, you can go ahead and move on it. In an emergency, you have to get this, as you were saying, all the infrastructure, you've got to get back up quickly.
Yeah, no, Chair George, I mean, it's absolutely right. One of the things that's missing from my operation, and I'm trying to use other resources, is what I call, if you've ever been near the military, as a logistician, somebody to deal with logistics and resource management. And we're trying to set up contracts now. In fact, Monday this week, I met with the Building Trades Council here in Oregon. Because one of the first things you need, and I wanted to do a memorandum of agreement with them and get them on my little personal call list, one of the first things that you need after the initial response is you need plumbers, electricians, carpenters, bricklayers, the whole gamut. And these trade associations and unions are very, very organized.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like a small army. And if you can get to their leadership and work with them, you know, and it becomes an instant resource because generally, based on past history, one of the first things after a disaster, once people know that their lives are not in jeopardy, you know, they want, other than food and security, they want their lights back on, they want to get back into their home. Obviously, plumbing needs to be fixed right away, so, you know, trying to build that contractors list. And where I'm lacking, and it just is a matter of time, is, you know, as I can use ODOT and the different state agencies that have a lot of these, but there's many, many more contractors that really need to be put in place, pre-signed agreements, you know, and there needs to be the people that can de-conflict them, because I've way too many times we're all competing for the same resource. And part of that is de-conflicting that now so you don't have the problem when the disaster happens.
Well, many people that, as they've analyzed World War II, said that they believe one of the major reasons we won is because our forces have the ability, if you have a loss of their upper-level administrators, commanders, that the lower echelon has been trained to pick up the slack. And this is what Senator Gordley and I have been, you know, concerned about, is this idea, let's make sure that a person that may not even know about what's going on in the fellows lives in Hermiston would have something that if the emergency popped up, they could say, oh, wait a minute, I think I had something in my phone book. You know, so you always want something that you can get that person in to step up. And also, as we're talking about it, if you can get folks who you have proven to be trusted relative to being a contractor or something like that, to be able to have them be able to exercise some authority to actually deal with the problem. And during the flood back in the 90s, I can remember thinking, this is crazy. Every farm around there is a dump truck. Why aren't we activating all of these, you know, this pent-up momentum to get something done?
Yeah, sure, George. You know, you bring up a good point that, you know, doing these type of things and organizing the private sector or the public sector before the event actually will save you from the next disaster. Because we saw in Hurricane Katrina, everybody with their open hearts, their goodwill, they just all raced to New Orleans to help. And that causes your next disaster if it's not organized. And so, you know, those are the key things and preparations that we need to do is to build that war chest, if you will, of resources and phone numbers and contacts and, you know, agreements, you know, can we use you for this, and save us. Well, number one, it'll save us time in front of a camera and a microphone, and number two, it will better serve our citizens and get them back on the road to recovery quicker.
Mm-hmm. Another thought comes to mind. Mr. Murphy, we were talking in our last meeting. Mm-hmm. There was a suggestion about talking to the Secretary of State.
Yes, I have an appointment.
As I recall from my conversation with the Secretary of State about getting emergency preparedness information into the voter sample, he referenced state law, which says particularly what can be in the state or in the what I'm still unclear on is whether he's saying to me that it's prohibited from including anything else, or whether there's some way that we can look for flexibility to.
I'll do some research, because otherwise, it might be a short meeting with him.
Or get the bill written right now.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially something that goes to every citizen.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's blank pages on there that you guys can notice that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's space left, mm-hmm. too, you know, whole pages of these.
And that's really
one other suggestion might be the Department of Revenue tax book.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. they must receive something. I'll try and move this right along here, and I want to just notice, too, that each one of these benchmarks has a little green dot by it, and that we just recently went through a test here last month, and we fully achieved compliance and sustainment in those two, so the folks out there in those two counties and all those cities really have done well. I mean, they constantly train for this. and at the same time it supports their day-to-day operations for any type of first response to anything. So it's very complimentary, you know, in training them and using this money for this particular event helps them with their job normally.
Are these benchmarks sort of the same benchmarks we will use or do we use for any of our emergency preparedness?
Chair George, representing March, some of them we do use, but I will be very candid with you. We don't have the money to be able to test some of these. Senator Gordley has been so helpful with me, public outreach and education. I had no way until a couple weeks ago to even start achieving that one. So, I will say a lot of this would not have been possible without the $101 million we got from the federal government over the years. It just simply, and we have some of these in place with Homeland Security, but not all of them. And we're very, very well aware of them and try to do what we can in certain areas. Let me tell you one that is probably weak is emergency operations centers. You know, there's not enough money to ensure that every city and county has a good operations center, one that's not tucked in some little side room with a couple of phones, one that has the proper equipment, maybe doesn't have a backup generator, you know, little things like that, you know, that just are money-dependent and resource-dependent, you know, to make sure that we have functional things, you know, to support the communities.
And I know we can't force media to do something like this, but also, you know, we used to have those public service announcements that would be put out there. But if you think about it, if you're doing a documentary on tsunami, we were talking about that a little earlier, Senator, is that when you got to the end of the video, or the end of this documentary, I thought, why don't they tell you what they should have done? Why not just a short amount that said, you know, this is what they should have done? Some of it were the people fled into the hills and the wave was coming right behind them, all that sort of thing. You know, every person would spot that. But, you know, I don't know why we can't include some of that. Or, you know, like, for example, with what Multnomah County has been doing. And that is to say, you know, the little PSA that says, do you know that available to you from Multnomah County or the website or something like that is this thing? When they're talking about a problem, we're talking about a short distance to Channel 3 and Channel 6 and 8 and 12. And to get their people to start thinking about, don't just tell us what happened, tell us what we might do in case something like that happened in our community.
Mr. Chair, I think there really is another concern and opportunity to talk with Mr. Murphy about how do we engage our media community in a way that has been taking the lead being part of the campaign, contributing the time and the resources, and this is in the public interest, which is very in the public good.
And they can write that on the report at the end of the year, but it's supplied to the federal government.
I just envision a meeting, sit down with the heads of all those media companies, inviting them to use their creativity to help do this for us. So I'm reminded also of the survey that I asked Channel 2 News to do with the department. We recalled a few weeks ago there was the campaign that Bethel Moody was having on. She reminded somebody to come on and come in on the radio and prepare this activity. And my parting comment was, could you all do a survey of your staff and find out how many K2 workers are prepared in their homes, cars, career education, et cetera. Now we've made it a conscious thinking and planning that's our opportunity.
Chair Senator Gordley, Senator Gordley knows once I get this new public education and crisis communication person hired, I have a long, long, long list. Actually, I could probably hire a marketing firm to work for me forever. Is really, to some extent, you know, and this sounds a little flippant, but I mean, this is really about marketing citizen preparedness and community safety, and you know, it's something that you literally have to do it all the time because you're changing. changing culture and getting people to think differently. And you know, so it really is a marketing campaign to sell safety, you know, make communities safer. You know, it's just like we do with making our environment safer. I mean, it's a marketing technique to be able to have those things. So.
And does Homeland Security, we've mentioned this before in other hearings, do they have the preparedness videos, you know, to kind of walk down through like the brochure does from Multnomah County, this issue, this is what you do? Because, you know, we still have our cable access, and many times they'll just throw something like that into the rotation and let it go on forever. And it always shocks me because, you know, you normally think no one's watching those things, and then you're walking down the street and says, hey, I saw you on there, and you made this comment about a certain subject, and you realize a lot of people are watching it. And there's a lot of folks, in other words, as you raise the awareness, then there becomes the hunger to get the information, and Judith is our test case because as she listens to it, she gets more and more prepared. Then she starts to talk to someone else about it. So you can see that critical mass gets, you know, is reached, and then everyone's thinking that way.
You have to market it.
Yeah. Do you know if there's anything like that available?
Chair George, there are some videos. Frankly, Homeland Security, they're getting there.
Okay.
You know, they have a website called ready.gov, and they just issued some new information that we're reviewing right now on the Ready campaign. I think after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of epiphanies were realized, you know, that people do need to be ready. And so we're starting to see a lot more of that. Some videos, you know, are starting to come out, you know, about what families, what businesses can do, and what communities can do. And in fact, as I learned yesterday, I was in Hermiston in the chemical stockpile program. Homeland Security is filming some of the things they do out there to use as examples. Get a little notoriety for our folks here in Oregon. But they do have some, but I would say it's a long ways from an exhaustive, good library of, you know, things that we could use.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that stops us as a state from preparing things like that, too. You know, and because I think one of the things, you know, that I have on this long list for my public education, you know, is to tailor these messages for certain parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's culturally competent. You know, it looks at different communities, you know, to really take a look at, you know, because there's some messages that can be generic across the entire state, but others have to be tailored to your audience. And, you know, to make sure that the message is understood. So there's no reason that we can't do it either. And maybe getting these media outlets to do some filming or some things like that where we could mass produce a video or a CD or, and have it just on, you know, cable channels and things like that.
Checking with Oregon or OSHA, because we utilize a lot of their videos when we're doing training. And we've actually bought some of our own, but one of the things that we learned right off the bat was that does have an impact. People change their behavior based upon what they learned from the power of a video presentation is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, where they're dealing with chemicals, with leaks and exposure, what to do if the lights goes out in a fire situation, all of those, you know, could fit together. In fact, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking, well, why haven't you got those and got them out to cable access? But it's, you know, it's a resource that we have sitting in a library right there by the Capitol that may be already prepared for us. But there's a couple of them that I own. I think they would be really interesting to put out on the air, but they may have, you know, copyright restriction on it.
That's always a challenge. In fact, the stuff I sent to you, you know, about those preparedness things,
yeah.
I found quite a few, but copyrighted.
Copyrighted, yeah. So, we just plagiarized one of them. I have to admit to that on paper.
let me try and cover this. We talked earlier. I'm on slide 5. It really is a bi-county response to include Umatilla, Marl, and Benton County, Washington. They do use the incident command system, and it's a coordinated effort between the three counties. And as you can see, there's 28 overpressurized facilities, you know, to protect people, mainly children. And then we have some very robust decontamination capabilities, both permanent and mobile, where they have a truck and tractor rig that has the showers and, you know, those type of things to decontaminate people. Slide six, just to highlight one of the things, you know, one of the key critical things to any disaster, and chemical disasters are no different, is the public warning. Mm-hmm. How do you get a hold of people? And, I don't know, and I have not sent to the committee, and I will. President Bush just issued a presidential executive order here a few weeks ago about we must have a national alert and warning system. We want to change everything and contact every man, woman, and child in America. Tall order. So, but I think we've done a pretty good job out there. As I mentioned earlier, you can see tone alert radios. It's a small radio hooked in with the National Weather Service, so you can get alerts about weather issues too, and also chemical issues. They're in businesses and homes. Then we have a good array of sirens out there that give a audio tone, and then they have a verbal message in Spanish and English to be able to let people know. And then the highway message boards. Also the highway advisory radios, those are the yellow signs with the two blinking lights that says tune to AM 510 or 1610. And we have that set up so they can, you know, turn to their radio if they're traveling down a highway. And then, of course, the EAS system lights up too. And then the emergency operations centers are very well equipped and outfitted to be able to, handle the situation. Slide 7 there, just to highlight that they have a very nice, relatively new 450 megahertz tactical communication system that supports the first responders. It's a very, very good system that provides a great deal of coverage throughout the Tri-County area. Have video teleconferencing, Wi-Fi system. They set up a Wi-Fi system out there to ensure better connectivity, and also their first responders through a PDA device or their mobile data terminals in their vehicles can pull up chemical emergency plans. They can pull up a plot of where the plume is moving. So it gives them a ready source, just as any of us might go to a hot spot at a coffee cafe here, and you can log on and be able to get that data for first responders. And we also like to brag, it's one of the largest Wi-Fi areas in the nation, 600 square miles. So, and they've also, now that we've put that in out there, they're finding much more usable features where it helps other people other than just first responders. You know, it's reduced some workloads, it's helped people do things within city and county systems. I know the Hermiston Police, I don't know if they gave a demonstration due to it, but they have camera systems in their Hermiston that use this Wi-Fi, and they can watch from their cars and help with traffic incidences even if they're not there. And so this has a lot of secondary benefits. And then the part of this, too, is an evacuation control system. So even a first responder, if there's a police officer on the street, he could use this Wi-Fi system. He can go in and tell to change the signals and see traffic cameras and be able to manage evacuation systems. And then I mentioned earlier they got a very good training and exercise program to make sure that their first responders and elected and appointed officials and everybody in the chain of command, are well aware of what to do and how to do it and practice it. And then slide 8, I won't expand on this anymore. A very good, robust public education program. You've obviously heard me say how important I think this is. It's just something that you have to do, and I think it's the right thing to do for the citizens to make sure that they have every opportunity to learn about the hazards of their community and how to do it and how to protect themselves. And slide 9, just a reminder that, you know, when we have these other systems in place, like the chemical stockpile program, there are obviously very good values to the community because you can use the equipment and the training and that type of thing for other events. If you're not aware, which I'm sure you are, earlier this year, they had a Navy aircraft crash out there, and I truly believe that with the training and the equipment that we had, we were able to respond to that, you know, much quicker, much more effectively, you know, than if we would have not had all of this. It really made a difference in having all the different pieces of the system there, to include the Joint Information Center and the EOCs operating to help the Navy, you know, in dealing with that accident. So I think it really made a difference, because when you get out in the rural parts of the state, you know, if they would not have had all the money and the training, you know, they may not have been able to help as quick and as effectively. And so I think this has really made a difference, you know, in being better prepared to deal with all types of events. Slide 10 really talks about, as we, and we knew this day would come, someday this program would come to an end, and it's getting there. And we're now working. In fact, that's why I was over there yesterday. We were really discussing, you know, about how can we maintain some of the things that we have out there once the chemical stockpile dollars go away. And so we've got a few years to work on that. But just simply, you know, it's just enhanced the ability, really, not only for those communities out there in those two counties, but probably on a regional basis, you know, those two counties to bring to bear a lot more than they normally would have, so that we can use them in the future. And we're simply looking at how we can better use everything and find other funding to maintain that as we go through the process of closeout.
With regard to the funding piece, the fund for
Chair George, Senator Gordley, somewhat of an unanswered question. We're in, not we personally are in debates about when does maximum credible protection of the public end. As I mentioned earlier, before you arrived, they're in the process of burning the worst of the chemicals. Should be done sometime in 2008 if everything goes perfect. Then you get the mustard gas, which I'm not a scientist or an expert. But you practically have to put your face in it to get hurt. But the question is, do they keep funding the program while that is there, or do they start reducing funding, or do they maintain full funding until the very last drop of chemical weapons are destroyed? And then there's even the point, which we're looking at between 2012 and 2013. And that's assuming everything works relatively in line and on time and without accidents. And then, you know, what to do, one of the great issues, you know, the federal government paid for a lot of this, and do they want it back? Are they going to give it to us? Then how do we maintain it? Good example is the 450 megahertz radio system.
Mm-hmm.
That was a $10-plus million radio system that was paid for by the federal government. So the community right now is in this process to determine how they're going to have a governance structure and how are they going to financially, you know, maintain the use, and what would we charge local entities to be able to use that system. So they're looking at all of those different things. What do you do with the overpressurization system in schools? Are the schools going to want it? Will the federal government say, kind of, no, we want it back? I doubt it. But, you know, just issues that the community has to deal with an idea in mind that, at least from my perspective, and I could speak for most of the community out there, we don't really want to degrade their abilities. I mean, a lot of training and effort and time has gone into it, and we'd like to maintain it. You know, it's just two counties and eight more cities that are much better prepared than they ever were. And I, you know, we surely don't want to go backwards in this business if you don't have to.
But what I'm suggesting, Mr. Chair, in this county is that we need to create the position that the challenge, the budget that
Chair George, Senator Gordy, you're absolutely correct, because I, even my own employees, You know, I've got employees that are fully funded by the chemical stockpile program. Now, granted, some of those may not necessarily be needed in the future if that program goes away, but there's others that I do believe at this point in time there are future funding challenges for me, how I look and manage, you know, emergency management across the state.
That can probably be very valuable. The other thing is, I think it's critical for us to monitor whether or not the community can be encouraged to pick up these responsibilities. In other words, you can see the schools are part of the education operation, you know, your local service clubs and the Boy Scouts and groups like that just naturally fitting into this type of preparation and education plan.
Yeah, and Chair Jordan, a good example, you know, this chemical threat will go away someday, but one of the things that I really don't want to lose is I truly believe we've instilled it in the culture of the people in those two counties. You know, and what a tragic waste to lose a lot of those people, both citizens and businesses, you know, because that mindset, be prepared for everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it really doesn't take that much effort, you know, and to lose that momentum and, you know, and what we've done for the children and the adults out there, you know, they should have that same attitude for earthquakes and floods and
the volcanic activity.
Yeah, or anything that could be a threat to them.
That's volcanic ash soil for a reason.
Yeah.
It's somehow got them.
So, you know, and to me, those are some of the, you know, real tragedies of these programs if we're not careful and we don't plan for them correctly in the future. You know? I hope that it'll be well recognized. The chemical stockpile community is working with other communities in Utah and Maryland that are in the closeout, much closer to truly closing out, and trying to look at the lessons learned and see what the issues are and what they have to face. And I agree with the committee that, you know, we as the state, you know, should keep an eye on this because, you know, we don't want to lose it and we don't want to lose what they've done and invented, so we don't have to reinvent the wheel too many times. I think on the last slide, it is noted, you know, and I don't say this just biasly, that it is one of the better prepared communities across this nation because of the chemical stockpile program. It wasn't always that way, but it surely is now. And I do believe, as I've said many times, the legacy that they have, the lessons that we've learned, are good lessons that we should use throughout the state and use the expertise that's out there, you know, to help us. And with that, I will answer any questions that you might have.
I see I got here at the appropriate moment.
Sir, how are you?
Hold up a chair. Now, get your question book out. Please be practicing. You have 30 seconds to scan it. You
know, scan it.
You think you're a media person, you can do that now.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, now, since we have you here representing this stuff, and you have a radio program, don't you think it would be appropriate if we talked about preparedness on that program sometime?
I think it'd be a great thing as long as we didn't scare the living daylights out.
Well, you and I would scare.
No, we would never do that. But maybe Senator Gordley or Representative Marks would like to come on and talk about preparedness.
It's always a great opportunity to have a conversation with people.
I think when we have opportunities like that I would always refer to experts.
Okay.
I'd be more than happy to do it.
Well, you know, the good thing about that is that every opportunity we can take to keep the whole idea of individual preparedness, responsibility in front of people, the average person out there living their life who, frankly, is not just not thinking about these kinds of things, is a good thing because it helps them remember that, hey, you know, I should have a little extra water in the closet or the pantry and a little extra food and, you know, maybe a battery-operated radio. This thing's just kind of the basics there. And the more we keep talking about that, I think it's positive. You should.
I agree.
we'll schedule that program.
Absolutely, we'll schedule it.
Yeah, better not be you and I. We would share them.
Well, we probably
would. You better get the stuff right now. We don't know when this is going to happen. Well, it looks like we're up to the lunch hour here, huh? So, is there any other questions? Yeah. Got no problem there.
I have one question.
Yes. Do
you participate in the council for the court? I don't know if it's the court on the part of the city's effort to
there's Chair George Senator Gorley. That one I don't, but there's two others that I do. The Regional Emergency Management Group, which is a group of emergency managers, elected and appointed officials, many other different personnel representing groups, and then the Urban Area Security Initiative has a core group that meets. Citizen Corps Council, I do not. I do have one individual in my office that works Citizen Corps that tries to attend those meetings. So, yes.
If you have it, I want to know.
What's really required right now is the quality of leadership that says, that speaks truth, that says, these mm-hmm. are the things that you do have in place, these are the gaps, this is where you need to light a fire. You know, that's the kind of leadership. Mm-hmm.
Chair George Senator, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, certain people can do all they want, but you still need leadership to take note and pay attention and to set some standards. And most of us in our experiences throughout life, you know, and especially if you're in the military, you know, you will do what your leader says or looks at and pays attention to. And it really does take that because as much as I hate to admit it, you know, emergency management sometimes does take a backseat because it's not an emerging issue, you know, that is in people's face that causes problems. But it is an insurance policy if one looks at it that way, that there are things that you can do, you know, to help out. And at points in time, we do have to stand up and, you know, remind people how important certain things are. And then, of course, try and twist their arm to do a little bit more before the disaster, too.
When Prep and I talked about an issue, it might have actually been right after the first meeting, and that was this territorial attitude about, for example, you know, you serve on a local volunteer fire department. Many times, there in the past, it's been, well, that's mine, that's his, we don't work with them. And one of the reasons I think these hearings are so valuable is because we begin to see that we are coloring in the little green dot next to that issue. Do you see that this is diminishing? I seem to see more cooperation than I've ever seen before, and that really makes me smile, you know.
Yeah,
are you seeing
George,
that, Ken?
I do, and, you know, and I'd like to brag. I think Oregon was kind of ahead of the pack in a lot of that. I really think a lot of our organizations, whether they were first responders or not, you know, worked together. But even those that did have their separations, you know, I think have made some good strides and a lot more groups that, you know, you just wouldn't have ever even thought to talk to. You know, people are coming to the table and saying, hey, I'm interested in this. And, you know, it's just... you know, like I said earlier in testimony, I just got a call from the Building Trades Council and Association, you know, and they were said, you know, how do we get into emergency management so we can better support our communities? And you know, and so a lot more people are willing, I think, to work together and come to the table, because unfortunately we learned by these disasters and we saw how much suffering things have taken place, you know, over the last few years. And, you know, and I think if people will just take those small steps, you know, and I think Oregon's done very well. I mean, there's many more things that we can do to collaborate ahead of time. And, but I'm from what my standpoint, very proud of Oregon and what they've done. And hope we can keep pushing from every level of government and private business, you know, that it does not take much time or cost much money to shake a hand or give a business card and chat a little bit. Could save a life.
Absolutely right. When you mentioned the unions, it just brought back a memory of many years ago. We need to get a little walk bridge across the Yamhill River. And so a group of unionists at that time, I believe that was Smurfit, and, you know, that's a new print. The union got together and decided they would build it, okay? Mm-hmm. And because then you get a farmer who's going to transport it. So we're going to transport the bridge. So I moved the bridge. And we got it out there, and we said, how do we get it up? And one of the guys said, you need a logger. The logger get it across there tomorrow, you know, 15 minutes. And literally, it was Bryce Smith from Flying M. He got that thing across the river so fast. Many of our members were almost in panic that something was going to happen to the bridge. But the thought was, isn't it amazing that we didn't need a program to do it, but folks just recognized there was a need, but there's nothing that would be better than for us to coordinate those groups. And, you know, like we've all talked about here, you always want to look at what resource you have available. And when you look out there and you see the loggers and the farmers and all the construction industry and all the trade unions and everyone else that's out there, that's what they do every day. And when you can give them the positive incentive of not only compensation but helping their neighbor, I think you can to have a coordinator where everyone assumes that's what we're going to do. We're not going to stand by and wait. We're going to get that bus loaded with those kids and get them out of town. So, okay, well, we'll end this hearing at this time, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock. And if we don't have public comment, we'll just move all the schedule up a little bit faster. Okay, with that. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. It's 1 o'clock, a little after 1 o'clock, and the serious events subcommittee is in Portland today, and we're really pleased to be talking about some very serious issues, and one of those is Hanford site security. And I need to tell a story about I was going to buy a piece of ground right up there, in fact, right over there, and it was a beautiful farm, and it had all of these amenities, and I couldn't understand why it was so cheap, and the wife is dying of cancer, and so we went to look at the boat ramp, which went right down next to the, further around the river, only to find out that I said, what's that? And the person said, Hanford, thank you very much, I'll be going. So anyway, a few years later, what kind of condition are we in? In fact, many years later now, think about that story.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and happy to be here this afternoon. There has been some progress made. Some challenges remain on Hanford cleanup. And what I've provided for you is a brief fact sheet of some of the issues that are important on Hanford cleanup. I particularly wanted to point out the map on page 2 and emphasize that that map is about 25 miles in each direction. Hanford is really not one site, it's many sites. There's many different buildings that were contaminated that require cleanup. There were many different disposal cells, disposal sites that in retrospect were not handled well that need cleanup. There's major issues there. The Columbia River goes right through the middle of the site. Many of the reactors, and that's what those numbers, the letters K, M, H, and F refer to reactors that were operating at one time, particularly around the N reactor. There's still concerns about some of the groundwater that was contaminated close to the river and some of the springs areas, what they call the N springs, that continues to be a concern that US DOE is actively treating to try to mitigate the risks of contamination of the Columbia River.
Are they doing a foot intersection from that? Because I always hope that eventually we get below the bottom of the river and just continue to migrate downward. But this stuff, because of some of the upper elevation, you're saying it's going to actually end up in the river potentially.
Potentially.
If we don't intercept it.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's not at a level that would go into the river. And so for sites that are near the river, they're doing what's actually called pump and treat methods of treating the water and then trying to move that contaminated materials then further back inland. One of the biggest risks was spent fuel, high-level waste at the K reactor called the K basins. That was over 2,100 tons of spent fuel in two basins that were leaking. The canisters that held the fuel were corroding. This was an environmental disaster waiting to happen. U.S. DOE did make that a priority to clean up in the last few years, and all of that fuel has been moved inland into the 200 West and East area in a new building that's designed for spent fuel canisters. These are very heavy cement, thick cement canisters. They're lead shielded, that are designed for holding high level nuclear waste. So that risk, which was one of the most immediate to the Columbia River, has been removed. There are no operating reactors on the river anymore. There was a number of them in reactor, Purex, Fastflux test facility, which was not on the river but was on the site. None of those are operating, so the U.S. Department of Energy's total efforts are focused on cleanup now. On the third page is a picture of some tanks, underground tanks, partly exposed there. That's where a huge volume of the high-level waste is. These are tanks up to 1 million gallons in size that hold liquid high-level waste. There are 53 million gallons of waste in over 177 tanks. Over 60 of those we know have leaked, and that is those tanks are in the 200 East and West area, so that's some miles away from the river. But there has been contamination of the groundwater, and that groundwater does migrate potentially to the Columbia River, towards it, in both a direction to the east and direction to the north. And that's where a major focus is of intercepting that before it gets to the Columbia River. And then the waste itself, the most important piece of the liquid, dealing with the liquid waste, is turning that material into glass. It's called vitrification plant that's under construction. There have been some delays and cost overruns, but the plant is going forward. When that plant's complete, it's going to need to operate for anywhere from 2 to 3 decades or more. It will turn the waste into glass logs, essentially. It will still be very radioactive, but it will be in a form that's much safer, that can be contained in a building that's designed for it and air-cooled and kept in a safe storage until, if there's an ultimately a permanent repository for high-level waste open, then those glass logs, along with the commercial spent fuel throughout the country, would go there as well.
Thank you. When did construction begin?
On the vitrification plant?
Yeah.
I've been to, I think, 3 or 4 different groundbreakings up there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it originally was supposed to start construction in the early 90s and be operating by the end of 1999. We obviously haven't made that. Construction is underway now. And they're actually building, it's 3 plants. It's one to deal with the most serious high-level waste, and 2 others that will separate out what they call the low-activity waste that's easier to treat. Those low-activity melters are moving forward, but they're having significant problems with the biggest part of it. There are estimates that it could take up to another 10 years to complete. But construction is underway. It's probably a third complete in terms of the amount of material, but the time it may take longer.
The subject catches my ear, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Graney knows this. One of my first committee assignments
as a legislator back in the 1980s. And I remember the trip. Very sober, through the Columbia River, running through that whole area. And Mike has been looking at the picture on page 3 of the underground storage tank. Locate the picture on the map.
Those tanks are in both the square shapes in the middle of the map, the 200 west area and 200 east area. Those are where all the modern waste storage facilities are, including the high-level waste tanks and also the spent fuel building and a place called ERDF is the Environmental Restoration Disposal Facility, which is a modern facility designed for low-level waste on site.
I'm not as familiar anymore with Columbia, but I can remember 91, 92, 93 having the discussions there about converting into the glass wall. And a lot of discussion around whether that could happen, whether that would be right to have to follow, and then a lot of concern about funding, whether the funding would actually be there to complete the entire project.
Mm-hmm. Well, and on funding, we've seen funding for cleanup at the site since the early 1990s. It really has increased a lot overall. We were in those days looking at $50 to $100 million a year. Now we're over $2 billion at the site, about per year, $2 billion per year. About half of that is for non-vitrification related activities. So that was involving things like the spent fuel removal. And the cleanup, the funding for, in general, I think has reached a sort of a momentum that it's carrying itself forward. It's gotten a lot of support, not only from both Oregon and Washington members of the congressional delegation, but throughout the country. But the vitrification plant has caused concerns because of the delays and the cost increases, and that is an issue under serious review right now in Congress. Unfortunately, I don't think we have good alternatives. Vitrification has been used at other sites, the Savannah River site in South Carolina and the West Valley site in New York State. Seems to be the best process of treating this, but we can't leave it in tanks that are leaking. If we build more tanks that are also very expensive, up to $100 million for a large tank, that buys us perhaps a couple of decades, but not long-term storage that we need, pending ultimate disposal of these things. And it's not in nearly a safe form as the solid glass would be. So it's I think we need to move forward on the big plant. Those cost issues have to be addressed, but it's I think our only alternative at this point.
Mike, it says that Oregon has no regulatory authority over Hanford cleanup. Do we have any hope? Because they go on to talk about in page 3 about some of the concerns and obviously irrigation, all the fish,
right,
the contamination of water that's coming right through the city that we're in right now.
Right.
And of course, here again, we're talking about a real good pollution ratio. But when I watched a couple of documentaries on this a few years ago, and the first thought I had is, what happens if they can't intercept it, and we actually have an entry into the river?
Mm-hmm.
And in the worst-case scenarios like that, do we have any hope whatsoever to recover from them? Because what we might be doing someday is building a gigantic, very expensive conduit to intercept the water above, get it up on land, and take people away from the river in order to provide water, you know, for our future needs.
Right.
Which, you know, this could be unbelievably expensive. It starts to sound like this project to divert the Columbia, you know, into the deserts of California, Nevada, and Arizona.
Right, Mr. Chairman. The risks for Oregon are very high from here, the potential risk that things go badly, either from contamination like that or from an accident. The risks of explosions, particularly from the plants that were operating, were significant. There's concerns about and have been concerns about potential explosions in the underground tanks. Now they're,
right.
they're covered with almost 10 feet of soil, which would mitigate the impact, but still could be potential. And you saw firsthand the risks of the impacts of prior discharges from Hanford.
Yeah, mm-hmm. didn't think they could just dump it out on the ground. It was amazing to watch that. I mean, I mm-hmm. wouldn't want to walk near it. Mm-hmm. Do we have sensors all along the river to detect if we have, you know, that are at very depth inside of the soil to detect any possible radiation migration?
We do some monitoring. And the state of Washington does, and the city of Richland, which is just south of this chart on the map. The city of Richland's boundary starts just below the map, actually takes their drinking water from the Columbia River. So the residual...
That's a significant issue.
Don't be chlorinated.
Well, and that doesn't...
Fluoride.
You know, that doesn't mean there aren't already issues further downstream because the river doesn't flow uniformly. But it is heavily monitored. And we've been able to increase our monitoring because of some increase in federal funding the last few years.
Now we're talking about in water or actually back at the site. I'm thinking about intercepting the plume, detecting it early, knowing what.
Well, Oregon does river monitoring. The U.S. Department of Energy does do on-site monitoring, and we're involved. We're able to review those reports. You asked what we're able to do. Since we don't have a regulatory role, we have tried to, I guess, inject ourselves every way we could in the technical reviews. Our staff, we have seven people working on Hanford issues, and they're at the site often, sometimes a week solid, working with US DOE and its contractors and the state of Washington, which does have regulatory oversight. We have a formal memorandum of understanding with both US DOE and Ecology, where it provides for exchange of information and periodic meetings, including amongst, I meet with the site manager and with the director of the Department of Ecology. We have a similar one with the Umatilla Indian Tribe, mm-hmm. which is, has ceded treaty rights that have been affected by Hanford. And we have a number of communities within the 50-mile emergency planning radius. It's the traditional emergency planning radius for a nuclear facility. Hermiston, Umatilla, Boardman, and parts of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and smaller towns there are all within that 50-mile radius. So we also work with USDOE on emergency drills, and part of that gets into security issues as well. And the scenarios can be accidents or they can be intentional. And we do those drills at least twice a year. FEMA evaluates them. And they'll evaluate each of us. You know, they'll evaluate our role in Oregon, what Washington State's doing at their Emergency Operations Center, what USDOE's doing. And since 2000, every drill we've had, FEMA has graded us as meeting all their requirements and with no deficiencies. So we've been very pleased with that.
So, then, would you say that we are doing as much monitoring as is needed, given the current conditions and given what is required through those emergency drills, or is there a need for more monitoring?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I think more monitoring would certainly give us better data, a better sense of reassurance. But we think we've got enough data sources that we would see if there were problems. We've been able to determine based on that data that there has not been significant downriver contamination. The groundwater that has been contaminated is going to need to be intercepted. There's no question about that. But we do have some time. Part of the issue there is prioritizing within USDOE which things they do first, and that goes back to their budget. And we are actively involved in pushing them to focus on the groundwater as a priority, because that is, for us, one of the key issues, because of its importance to the Columbia River.
One of the things that's in there, you saw me passing it around, is radioactive waste is transported across Oregon and Brantford now on nearly a daily basis. So they're accepting more material in?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it varies. There have been proposals to bring large amount of waste from other sites, and we have opposed that, and the state of Washington has opposed that, because we think Hanford's got enough problems of its own. There were some proposals to consolidate other sites that had small amounts of waste, and we could see that as a temporary basis towards ultimate disposal, but we don't want Hanford to become a permanent national dumping ground.
Mm-hmm.
We do see virtually every shipment of radioactive waste into or out of Hanford comes through Oregon for at least 200 miles. In fact, I have a report here on radioactive transport through the state. We work with U.S. DOE on timing of shipments so they don't send in bad weather. Most of the shipments are low-level waste at this point. Although low-level waste is a term that can cover everything from things that literally you can stand right next to some fairly hazardous material. So the fact that it's low-level waste doesn't always mean it's without risk.
Do they guard that shipment differently if it's in fact it might be something that might be of a dirty bomb interest to a terrorist?
Yeah. And for example, we do have a few shipments of weapon shipments a year. When those happen, security is very tight. And in some cases, we just get a few minutes notice because of security.
They don't want to.
Right. But generally, they work with us on which routes to take, where there's safe parking places in the event of suddenly bad weather coming up. We inspect the trucks. We actually, ODOT does the inspections for us, for truck safety. And we've been working with the state of Washington Department of Transportation so that our folks actually go up and inspect the shipments at the Hanford site. So then they don't have to stop because they're coming in because it's only 30 miles away. But we're satisfied, you know, when we leave the Hanford site that they meet our safety requirements.
Do we have any longer weapons on the 5-quarter?
We have one.
In the past, I've heard reports that they've shipped nuclear weapons on Highway 5.
I think that has happened at times in the past.
There was an incident some years ago where they came off the system fast. Set it down for nesting. That's checking the facility. They were nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually when you're right, fire marshal will tell me the story. Mm-hmm. So it does happen, and they're heavily guarded.
Well, that's a good example because trucks do have accidents. And we've had incidents of trucks carrying radioactive material where the truck goes off the road in bad weather.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we haven't had breaches of the shipping containers. But in one case where we do not have advance notification, and this has evolved through time, the federal government originally didn't want to give us advance notification. Some local police came out, the emergency responders, and were confronted with two armed guards when one approached the vehicle, and didn't know if it was safe to approach or not, and you know what the nature of the material was. We've improved on that a lot, so we know what kind of material is coming. We train the police and the fire departments and other emergency responders all along the shipping routes, both I-84 and I-5, and also US-97, because we do get some shipments through up US-97, so that they know what kind of material is there and how to deal with it, and whether it's okay to approach or not. Mr. Chairman, Senator Gourley, very infrequent. That is something U.S. DOE has looked at, especially if they open up the repository for high-level waste. But they might use trains. We do have occasional shipments, and we do have we work with the shippers just like we do with the truckers on rail safety, but we haven't had very many of those. That are non-radioactive may be even more worse than some of the things. All right. We mentioned also at Hanford, and it's down at on the right side, Energy Northwest, a little square that's jutting in up there from the right side of the map. That is a commercial power plant, formerly known as Lux 2. And that is independent of the USDOE Hanford site. It's just located there. We also work with Energy Northwest, the utility that runs that, on emergency training, emergency response. We do drills with them as well as with USDOE. And again, FEMA evaluates those. And we have, and both USDOE and Energy Northwest have security around their sites, and that security, the security provisions have been increased since 9/11, increased significantly. In a sense, Hanford presents less security risks, I think, now than it did 10 years ago when we had more operating facilities. Most of the material is in a form that's not either easily usable or easily accessible, such as the underground tanks that are under 10 feet of soil. There's one facility at Hanford called the Plutonium Finishing Plant that does have special nuclear material. And the whole point of Hanford originally was to create plutonium. So this is where they keep the plutonium. That plutonium is in the 200 West area. It's ways back from the river. The security is extremely tight. The guards there have authorization to use deadly force. I mean, it's the most heavily guarded part of the compound. But to give you a sense of overall security at Hanford, the U.S. Department of Energy is spending about $80 million a year in security for the whole site.
Mm-hmm. Big site.
It is. It's a big site, and we take security obligation seriously. My staff, when they go up there, they have security clearances that have been run by the federal government in order to have access to the site. Otherwise, people are not allowed on the site without escorts, and it's very tightly controlled.
Is there any, if the decision was made to produce more weapons, would they be produced? Would the high-grade enrichment occur there?
Mr. Chairman, not with the current facilities. There really are no. Okay. They would have to build a new facility to be able to do that. USDOE is building a facility at the Savannah Riverside that would be a production facility. There's no place, and there's possibility of doing one at Idaho. There's a reactor that might be used. But the Idaho Engineering Lab site, which is near Idaho Falls, southeast Idaho, there are no plans to build anything that I'm aware of at Hanford that would fit into the production chain.
Too much attention when I look at Hanford to exposure to too many people.
Karen, I think that concludes my presentation on Hanford. I'd be happy to answer any questions or go into more detail.
Thank you. I probably should have remembered this from when I was on the Hanford cleanup board. But what's the time projected guess of the plume, the underground plume from the contamination of hitting?
I think the earliest contamination, I have to double check, but I think it's about 10 years. for the first part of the plume. The plumes are very large under the site there. In fact, but we know at least 1 million gallons of high-level waste would be, and so it's a significant amount of potential contamination there. And USDOE is looking at a number of ways of, the most direct way is to dig in and pull the stuff out and pump and treat, but that would be very expensive. They've been looking at other technologies like vitrification in place, which is sending giant electrodes into the ground and tapping it with the roof and trying to freeze it. They've looked at a number of other technologies over the years, but those have, at least so far, proved unsatisfactory. It's probably going to require just direct physical interception and pump and treating, which is the old traditional way of dealing with contaminated waste.
Freezing is an interesting idea. You see that working. Yeah, well, I mean, you're going to be running the reactor to run the refrigeration unit.
That's correct. Right. But there is a burial ground from that USDOE used of material. In fact, there are literally hundreds of sites on the Hanford site that have contamination. And at one point, some of these, some of the operating reactors just discharged directly into the soil, into the ground. Some cases, they dug holes and trenches intentionally, but then it was basically online, just dirt. Other cases, there were buildings, but they certainly weren't designed for decades. They were designed for a few years, and this waste has just been sitting there. Mm-hmm. And one of the sites, this burial ground, is actually under the parking lot at Energy Northwest. It's not high-level waste, but it is contaminated. And it's going to require treatment. So that's what that represents.
And the half-life is what?
Half-life varies. In some cases, it's as long as, I mean, it's hundreds, thousands of years. And plutonium, which is hundreds of thousands of years.
Right.
Some of the high-level waste, some of that that's the most immediately dangerous, but the half-lives are relatively short. Something like cesium that I think is about 60 years, that means it's dangerous for 600 years because it's you multiply it by 10 until it's...
Very dangerous.
That's right. It takes 10 times the half-life to really get down to a level where it's not really a threat. So these are huge time frames that require permanent action.
That's what was disturbing, I think, when you watch the documentaries. It was a kind of careless... lack of preparation. I mean, you didn't think it through. We knew what that stuff was like. I mean, I have stuff that goes back into the early 50s that I accumulated on the risk of radioactivity. Mm-hmm. And you know, so as a young person, I was very much aware that, you know, we're looking at a lot of problems with this stuff in the future. Yeah. But I'm sure it was budgets, and we wanted something that went boom real big, and so we just proceeded full ahead.
Well, and during World War II, the river was used for direct cooling. There was no... at least they built these large tanks after the war, but unfortunately they never really replaced them. They were designed for 20 years and they've been there for 50, 60 years.
Because looking at steel tanks, mm-hmm. and you and I both know what's going to happen to that. Hey, moving right along to good news.
Well, actually, by comparison, I think it is. It's the Trojan nuclear plant. The Trojan nuclear plant was like the Wilkes II plant, a commercial power plant, about the same size, or about 750 megawatts, like the size of three natural gas plants. It operated till 1992, or through 1992, it was permanently shut down in 1993, largely because of economic problems caused by the steam generators. The steam generators that are sitting on the floor of the commercial plant for generating electricity were corroding massively and got to the point where they'd have to be replaced, which was hundreds of millions of dollars, which was at the time almost the cost of the power plant itself. And basically, PG&E made the decision to shut the plant down permanently and focus on natural gas plants, which at that same time were coming in very cheap to build, which still are relatively cheap to build, but also at the time natural gas was very cheap in terms of fuel, so it was very cheap to operate. Unfortunately, natural gas prices have gone up a lot since the year 2000, but there's no question I think it was the right economic decision for PG&E, and it resolved a lot of issues that people had with the safety of the plant as well. The power plant was always subject to both NRC regulation, the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and our Energy Facility Siting Council. That's a citizens panel that appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and we provide technical staffing for the council. So the council continues to have jurisdiction. Decommissioning of the plant began in 1995, and that involved removal of the steam generators, four large ones, very large in size, that filled a huge barge compared to individual size, as well as the pressure vessel. Those were the primary equipment that had significant contamination besides the spent fuel. I'll come back to the spent fuel.
So they were radioactive.
Yes, and that's, well, they became radioactive through operation. That's normal.
You're accumulating it a little bit at a time.
Yes. Yes. The level is what's low level, and so they're able to be disposed at the Hanford site. And there's one of the things at the Hanford site, after having talked about all the waste problems there, is there is a commercial operating low-level waste site at Hanford, and it's designed for things like that, like steam generators. The submarine hulls from the naval reactors go there as well. Mm-hmm. To decay over time. The level is low. I stood next to steam generators on there before they were being loaded on barges. It's safe to do that, so it's not high a level of radioactivity, but it's high enough that under federal and state standards, it can't just be left there.
Yeah, because if we ran through recycling, we still have a diluted radioactive in there. Because I've been told that we literally monitor a lot of steel coming in because of fear of it coming out of Asia and Europe, you know, with that kind of radioactive contamination.
Yes, but correct, Mr. Chairman. In fact, we did have an incident one time about 10 years ago of some tables from Mexico that had contamination on the table legs. And don't recall the specifics of the source, but we were able to crack that down and retrieve those.
How were you able, Mr. Chairman, if I may, how were you able to ascertain, Michael, that there was radioactivity associated with the legs of these tables?
Mr. Chairman, if there's trouble, I believe, actually, it was an alert that NRC put out. They had heard about it, and when we got some more information, and in fact found that some of those tables had made their way to Oregon. And I don't remember the specifics of how this radioactivity came into Mexico, because I don't believe they have any operating commercial reactors in Mexico. Some of the other Latin American countries, too, but I don't believe Mexico does.
So they may have sourced it from another country, bringing it in, making the product, shipping it to us, and finally.
Right, exactly.
So that would be one of the good things about the port sensitivity of the radioactive detectors, mm-hmm. that you might pick up on products that might have low levels.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Right. So Trojan's been going through this decommissioning process. They actually had to file a plan that was reviewed and approved both by the NRC and by our siting council, and we did that through a public process a few years ago. As you know, the cooling tower was imploded a few weeks ago, but that cooling tower had no radioactive material. So by then, except for the spent fuel, all of the other buildings on site are clean in terms of radioactivity. And that includes the containment dome. That's the circular dome you can see from I-5 and if you're driving up by Kelso. The steam generators and the pressure vessel and the other equipment that were in that dome did have contamination when we moved, but the dome itself is not radioactive, and there are plans to implode that building as well, probably in 2008. PG will be there. But the rest of the Trojan site has been reviewed and cleared, both by NRC and by the Siting Council for other uses, again, except for the spent fuel that's on site. I'm going to talk about that. And,
you probably heard about the question we asked earlier.
I did, although I forgot it. All
right.
What I have for you are three different pictures of the spent fuel containers. I did that so you could get a sense of the size. The spent fuel, when it first comes out of a reactor, is not only extremely hot in terms of radiation, it's also chemically very hot and needs to be cooled in a what's called a spent fuel pool. It's basically a large swimming pool, and it's kept there for probably about 5 years before it can be, at a minimum, before it can be dealt with in any other way. And Trojan had one of those spent fuel pools. All commercial reactors do. But 2 years ago, PGE was able to remove all the spent fuel out of that spent fuel pool and put it into what's called dry cask storage, and that's what these casks are. That has a lot of advantages in terms of, one, economically cheaper, it's simpler, it's safer, just in terms of potential contamination. These canisters that they're in, and you can see the size from the two black and white pictures that show the people in the pictures. Each of these canisters weighs, let's see, what's the number here? Over 300,000 pounds. So there's 34 of these casks in all that take all the spent fuel. I had mentioned before that Hanford, those K basins, had over 2,000 tons of spent fuel. Trojan spent fuel is much less. It's about 395 tons that are in these 34 containers. These containers are also in a form that if Yucca Mountain or another high-level repository ever opens, these are approved for shipping, so they would be put on a large trailer or a railroad car for shipment to Yucca Mountain. They're steel lined. They're 3 feet of concrete around them. They don't present a risk of radiation release in terms of the scan right next to them. In terms of security issues, we've worked with NRC and PGE on possible accidents as well as intentional events. Both we and NRC think that the risk of an accident and the outcome or of a terrorist action using that spent fuel, it's extremely small, and that's again another advantage compared to the spent fuel pool, where access to the fuel potentially could be higher. The Trojan site itself, you can see there's a fence around the spent fuel canisters. There's also down at the bottom, those are jersey barriers that surround the entire spent fuel area. And then the entire Trojan site, even though it's been cleared for unrestricted use, is still fenced. Access is limited. It's in order to get in there, you go through a sort of like a revolving door, except it's computer handled. You have to pass an approval from people inside for them to open up each phase of the revolving door to get you in all the way. PGE has a security force there that meets NRC standards, and we reviewed that as well. And again, without getting into details, give you an idea, they spend about $3 million a year on security-related staffing.
Okay, my question, you can see this one coming. This actually kind of shocked me a little bit, and because I'm looking at this, how would I attack it? And if, in fact, one or more of those containers was breached and the cooling liquid was released, how long before you had hot problems?
Mr. Chairman, well, first, it's no longer liquid. It's all solid.
Oh, it is solid.
Yeah, it is all solid.
Okay.
So it's in a form that's not going to be easily dispersed. Breaching those containers would be extremely hard.
So they literally pour, are you know, around the rods as they go, or are they?
No, these
are container, and they're inside.
They're inside. They're inside the container, 3 feet of concrete plus a steel liner, and then the fuel rods are inside that.
And the rods are so spent that there's no danger of them.
Well, if
going hot again.
Well, there would if the cask were open, there would be radioactivity.
Yeah.
In the event of a these were breached somehow, the indications we have, there could be some contamination on site, but not off site, on site at the Trojan plant itself. Yeah.
You really would need to, like, put up the area or something else like that if they're going to breach. Because, you know, if I'm looking at this, mm-hmm. I would expand the dirt berms.
Mm-hmm.
I would put a concrete retaining wall around tied to a floor, and I would have multiple sources of power to pump out of the river to flood that area. Is that necessary even to even consider that?
No, the issues like flooding and earthquakes.
No, I'm talking about the reflood. You know, actually put the containers underwater. This really sounds like there's no need to do
no,
that.
No.
Okay.
No. And also issues of, you know, it is near the river, obviously. You can see the river in the background, but it's out of the flood plain. That issue was looked at, earthquake integrity from earthquake impacts. Intentional trying to breach them with, you know, various bombs, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I think artillery shells could probably penetrate that thing. But, you know, and that's...
Again, the access, you're not going to be able to get close because the whole site, beyond what's in the picture here, this, if you're familiar with the site at all, you could drive up the old highway. There's some buildings and a park right by the road, and then there's this long road up to the site, and that's all secure.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get back to the control room.
3 feet of concrete is even hard.
I don't want to put on the record how I would attack the site, but, the main concern is that if, in fact, someone did get in there, let's say, for example, if you were able to get something capable of disrupting three or four of those containers,
mm-hmm.
What would happen at that point?
The worst-case scenario, we think, is that there would be some contamination on site, and one of the requirements that we had working with PGE is for evacuation of their employees from the site safely, if they can do quickly. They've proven they can do that. We don't think there would be any off-site release. It's not a situation like Hanford where, under worst-case situations, we could be looking at a very different situation.
Well, that's good news, because I was worried about it literally being suspended and held and moderated by liquid, because under this circumstance, you might have some minor release because of the explosion itself and carrying radioactive components into the air. That would be the greatest chance of contamination, do you think, or am I exaggerating that potential?
Mr. Chairman, there wouldn't be an explosion from the caused by the materials themselves. If you had an explosion otherwise that breached the container, that's where we think there could be some contamination on site, but very limited area.
A short drift area because you...
Right.
Yeah.
Because of the
particle
thickness.
Particle size would be generated.
And because of the thickness of the materials.
That's good
news. The other thing I'd like to mention is that since 9/11, we also upgraded our own ability to respond to an incident in terms of either intentional or accident. Once we we've established a backup emergency operations center in our own building. We can turn one of the conference rooms literally on 5 minutes' notice into an emergency operations center with the computers we need and the phones we need, dedicated lines to the state of Washington and USDOE and Columbia Generating Station. And we have used that a number of times. So
you would scram the guard and the Coast Guard?
Well, we would be in a position to be able to take whatever action was needed by having that room operational. And it's helped us in working with the Emergency Management Division as well to be able to act quickly. And we have used that a few times when there have been unexpected incidents at Hanford. Hanford notifies us immediately when there's either an incident or when they upgrade their security stage. They have security levels similar to the general security levels, the Homeland Security color-coded levels, 1 through 5. And USDOE does that as well. If they go above level 1, which is their normal level, they let us know.
Do you also send someone out to DOC?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we don't right away. They're one of the people we're in touch with. We do send people up to the site, we'd be able to send them to Pendleton if we needed to. Typically, our first thought is to send people up to the emergency operations sites that both USDOE and Washington run at Hampton.
Do we pre-authorize the folks protecting the site to use lethal force if, in fact, it, I mean, are we up to that? Because to me, those kind of things are deterrents.
The Trojan is current?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, they are armed. Let me say that.
Okay. That's a good one.
And I guess I'd rather not get into more detail
than that. But there's no problem with them. They will defend the site.
Yes.
That's kind of what I want to get on.
Yes, that's true. Yes. And that is true of Hanford as well.
As it should be.
That's right. Because over the years, we have learned that, you know, that the best deterrent is the fear of consequences to the perpetrator. And so, show of force on something like this and show of security is a deterrent in itself.
I think that's right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer any other questions on either subject at this point.
Oh, we did have. Oh, go ahead.
What's the long range plan on the casks here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, President Mark, if the the casks are in a form that the strike cast storage can safely be stored for decades. Seen estimates as long as 100 years or more. I hope it doesn't take that long to find out what we're going to do with our nuclear waste. But it's much, much better, for example, than the high-level waste tanks up in Hanford in a form like that. In fact, one of the proposals that was made a few years ago on the national level that's seemed to have lost its currency right now was to set up what was called a monitored retrieval storage facility, or MRS, at Yucca Mountain, using the canisters like that, having them there set to go, and then when and if Yucca Mountain is proven workable, then they go ahead with it. Of course, the issue was, what if Yucca Mountain doesn't work? Then you've got the stuff sitting there, and Nevada doesn't want it, and where does it go next? But it could be there. It could be on the operating reactors in the country are doing that for the fuel that they can take out of their spent fuel pool, because it is cheaper and it's simpler. Most of them are doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the latest status of Yucca Mountain?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crutt, Yucca Mountain continues to be evaluated by Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy, and fought by the state of Nevada. And there are licensing issues. NRC has to approve a license and is reviewing that, I believe, right now. I don't have a good time frame. estimates are that if it's approved, it could take as long as another 10 years before it would be operational. As a result, I think because of all that uncertainty, there's been some proposals just recently in Congress to use federal facilities for storage, and that always sends up a warning sign because the biggest federal facility is Hanford. And Hanford has been proposed before for a storage facility for commercial waste. That would certainly complicate cleanup, even if these are all in forms, you know, like the storage of Trojan, and the concern would be that once it's there, it wouldn't move out.
Yep. I do not have the information on this, but probably about 10 years ago, there was a discussion of the fact that the Soviets, when they built nuclear submarines and even some of their ships, that they didn't make a module that you could lift out of that thing, that was literally part of the structure of the submarine, and that they were actually sinking those things in some very deep areas. Do we know how they're doing with being able to secure these radioactive components, because we all exist on the same planet?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I don't have current information, but I know that issue was also true of both their weapons production facilities on land and some of the commercial reactors and how they've dealt with their spent fuel. In fact, one of the proposals that the U.S. Department of Energy and our national government was working with Russia on was plutonium disposal, where both countries would eliminate plutonium and dispose of it, and part of that, the goal was to try to deal with some of the environmental problems that Russia has with their waste. And I think that's still under negotiation. I'm not sure much actual progress has occurred on that.
Do you know, because one of the things I assumed that it was the problem, because I could cut my way into the center of that submarine and get that reactor, unless the control of that reactor was part of that structure, in other words, electronics and everything else. And that's what made me think that's why they're sinking them. They know they're going to get a release, and so they would rather have it at the depth of the ocean. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think that's a good idea either. But any information on that? I mean, this may be way out of what we should be looking at, but I'm really curious about this issue because I think we're doing a pretty decent job. I don't think others are doing quite as well.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know offhand. If you'd like, we could see what we could find on that. I'd be happy to do that.
Because it hasn't been many years ago, committees in this legislature threw a lot of dust in the air over high-sea drift nets. And, you know, and so every time a state or a nation can raise concerns about an issue, sometimes you see people making decisions between states.
Be glad to do that. We'll see what we can find out.
Thinking it out really quickly to the governor's press release, joins Hanford lawsuit against Bush. And I wish it hadn't been written this way, because I don't think it's Bush's problem. What we've heard is a lot of money is going after security sites and this sort of thing. But what could be accomplished that isn't being accomplished now by the lawsuit?
Mr. Chairman, the lawsuit deals with something called the Natural Resource Trustee Damage Assessment. It's it's one of the few decision-making roles Oregon actually has. It's recognized in law. We and the U.S. Department of Energy and the three affected tribes, Umatillas, the Yakimas in Washington, and the Nez Perce in Idaho, and the state of Washington are natural resource trustees that form a council. Mm-hmm. Their scope is, after the cleanup is finished, what's the damage, what type of compensation should be done. The normal context is a Superfund site where there's an industrial facility. I mean, this is obviously a site with much larger scope. And the Yakimas instituted this lawsuit a few years ago over frustration with the slow progress on the trustee process. We joined the lawsuit recently after the state of Washington did, in large part because negotiations are amongst the parties are ongoing, but the judge has set a deadline of intervene or not, and we felt it was necessary to have our options open, depending on whether negotiations prove successful or not. We've made some progress in some areas recently in terms of commitments from the U.S. Department of Energy. We're going to need to see follow-through. My hope is that the lawsuit will eventually become unnecessary and could be settled. Mm-hmm. But we don't know that at this point, and the judge basically gave us and everybody else who conceivably would be interested the first week of July to intervene. So we did, and so did the Umatillas. The Umatilla tribe also intervened.
Yeah, because I think that's something we need to watch, and that is the fact of what happens now. Where are we headed? Mm-hmm. Long-term, a problem that you've aptly described is real, and we don't want to bleed in with the problem not contained.
Right.
I guess. Any further questions?
Looking ahead to the next legislative session, mm-hmm. what additional guidance do you have for this committee? What else would you be looking at? What questions would you continue to raise?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gourley, I'd like to think about that one maybe, and that's one that maybe we can talk with our Hanford, what we now call the cleanup board, who's called the waste board as well. And we have six members of the legislature are members of that, and it'll give us a chance to look at that issue. In fact, the committee, the board is meeting last week of July in Portland, so I'll raise that with the board then.
How many years have you been doing this
work? I've been with the department since 1980 and been director now since for 4 years, since 2002.
No gray hair or anything?
Well, I don't know about that, but it's been fun.
well,
thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Is there anything further to come before the committee? If not, I'm going to tap that gavel. We're going to go home. All right. Listen, thank you guys for being here. And, I think one of the things that's come out of this committee is, first of all, educating us. I feel better today than I did early this morning. So I feel better this afternoon.
That's positive.
And that's a very good thing. I like to feel positive. With that in mind, we'll be adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.